listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the October 10th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. As many as 93 Palestinians in Gaza were injured, 37 with live fire a week ago Monday, during an effort by Gazans to extend the months of protest at the Israel-Gaza border to the Gaza shoreline. When a number of fishing boats set out to sea in what is recognized as Gaza's territorial waters, backed by an estimated 7,000 Gazans on the beach, they came under fire with live rounds from the Israeli Navy. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, medics and ambulances were also targeted by the Israelis, who have killed or wounded a number of clearly marked medical personnel since the middle of March. That's when the Gazans initiated weekly marches and protests at the border with Israel every Friday in what they call the March to Return, a reference to the homes and villages in Israel from which their families had either fled or been forcibly removed at gunpoint 70 years ago. Then last Wednesday, Israeli soldiers kill a Palestinian boy, shooting him in the head with a high-velocity gas bomb while wounding 25 others during protest near the Eretz Terminal crossing, now closed in northern Gaza. The boy, 15, was shot with a gas bomb which struck him directly in his head, lodging in his skull. A video shows gas pouring from the skull as a group of young men rushed to help him to an ambulance. The Israeli soldiers also targeted a Palestinian ambulance with a gas bomb and several live rounds near the crossing. The U.S. media ignored the story, as it has been largely downplayed, the dire situation of the Palestinians in Gaza, who have been subjected to three brutal wars by Israel over the past decade, combined with a suffocating blockade which has led a number of international observers to describe the Mediterranean coastline strip as the world's largest outdoor prison. Israeli snipers, protected by several layers of border, have killed at least 145 Palestinians and wounded several thousand, many with a new specially destructive bullet, since protests began in late March. Over that time, there has been one Israeli soldier killed, shot dead by a Palestinian in August. It has been 13 years since then Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon withdrew Israeli military and approximately 8,500 Jewish settlers from Gaza, the apparent goal of which was to cause divisions between the West Bank and Gaza and solidify Israel's control over Gaza, while giving its people independence from Israel in name only. In other words, Israel would maintain control of Gaza's borders with the collaboration of Egypt in the south of its airspace and its fishing waters beyond 3 nautical miles. When Hamas won the Palestinian elections the following year, Israel began a land and sea blockade of the strip that has lasted to this day, with Israel border officials determining what materials of any sort can be brought into Gaza and who is allowed to leave Gaza for any reason. Under those circumstances, the UN and international community, apart from the United States, still consider Gaza to be Israeli-occupied territory. As for the U.S., while they may have differed sharply over the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, both Democrats and Republicans have been united in backing Israel's bloody attacks on the largely peaceful protesters in Gaza who carry no weapons, endorsing Israel's claim that they have only acted in self-defense. To underscore that point, I should let you know that last month, both the House and the Senate, by voice votes, approved the first of 10 $3.8 billion annual installments for Israel so that it may purchase U.S. weaponry, part of a deal negotiated by President Obama before he left office. I was unable to find a single word about it in the U.S. media, and you certainly didn't hear it about it on NPR. In 2004, the year before Israel's withdrawal from Gaza, I was there with a small group organized by the Berkeley-based Middle East Children's Alliance. One afternoon, we were fortunate to have a meeting with Dr. Iyad Sarraj, a well-known Palestinian psychiatrist whose old friend Yasser Arafat, we learned, had him arrested 3 times over Sarraj's public criticism of the Palestinian Authority and the Oslo Accords. The conversation which took place in Gaza City has never been aired before, but what Siraj, who passed away in December 2013, had to say about what Israel's occupation had done to Gaza society, to the family relationships, to Gaza's children and the prospects for their future is sadly as pertinent and compelling today, 14 years later, as it was then. That's what you'll hear today at approximately 20 minutes past the hour. The big news yesterday, in the U.S. at least, was that Washington's ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley, had resigned, leading to speculation that she may be planning a run for the presidential nomination in 2020 should Trump not be on the ticket, or perhaps as Pence's vice president. Her resignation was greeted with dismay by the pro-Israel Jewish establishment and Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel. Haley, quote, was beloved in the pro-Israel community, including the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, which she addressed during its annual policy conference this year, wrote Ryan Torok in the Jewish Journal of Los Angeles. We appreciate the strong leadership of Nikki Haley at the UN, APAC tweeted following Haley's announcement. Thank you for consistently standing up for America's interest and our democratic ally Israel, end quote. During Haley's 20-minute speech earlier this year at APAC's annual convention, she received a dozen standing ovations. Haley's speech there, like that of all the other high-ranking U.S. officials, received no coverage in the U.S. media, although they were broadcast on C-SPAN and can still be found there. In response to Haley's announcement, American Jewish Committee, the foreign policy arm of the Israel lobby, also tweeted, quote, "We will miss her fearless voice," end quote. David Makovsky, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, an influential think tank formed by APAC in 1985, and once a guest on Takes on the World, believe it or not, said that Haley's rhetoric about the UN holding Israel to a double standard, coupled with her star quality, will make her difficult to replace in the eyes of Israel supporters. Which should make one wonder whether or not Israel should have been paying at least half of Haley's salary, or if she should have been forced to register as a foreign agent. Monday's New York Times carried an interesting story that you probably haven't heard headlined. A new wave of Democrats tests the party's blanket support for Israel, end quote. The article described how, quote, a cluster of activist Democrats, most of them are young, most of them cruising toward House seats this fall, has dared to breach what has been an almost inviolable orthodoxy in both political parties. Strong support for Israel, raising the specter of a crack in the Democratic Party that Republicans could use to attract Jewish supporters, end quote. The Democrats testing the boundaries of what the Times describes as, quote, the politically acceptable position on Israel in the mainstream parties, end quote, include Ihan Omar, a Somali-American Muslim running for an open House seat in Minneapolis, Rashida Tlaib, a Palestinian-American Muslim running in Detroit, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, running in a heavily Democratic district in the Bronx and Queens, and Leslie Coburn, co-author of Dangerous Liaison, the inside story of the U.S.-Israeli covert relationship, and sister-in-law to the late columnist Alexander Coburn, who is running in a Republican-leaning district in Virginia. Tlaib, a veteran Michigan state legislator, initially supported a two-state solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict, but has since moved to supporting a single state for both peoples. It has to be one state, she said. Separate but equal does not work, end quote. Omar, who had criticized Israel's, quote, evil doings in 2012, was accused on Twitter of anti-Semitism after her campaign got underway. Drawing attention to the apartheid regime, she said, is far from hating Jews. Brad Sherman from the San Fernando Valley, a leading pro-Israel voice in the House, admitted that, quote, I do worry that there are some on the extreme left of our party who adopt slogans, end quote, that are creating tensions. Ron Halber, executive director of the Jewish Community Relations Council of Greater Washington, D.C., dismissed the newcomers as a fringe with little influence. We're talking, he said, about a handful of people. They're certainly not going to move Congress's wall-to-wall support for Israel, end quote. His greater concern, he said, is that Trump's friendly relationship with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is getting Israel's narrative, quote, caught up in the anti-Trump fervor, which is not fair for Israel, end quote. Neither Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, a staunch supporter of Israel, nor House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, who may be only slightly less so, responded to the New York Times request for comments. The pro-Israel-Palestinian candidate's leanings, the paper pointed out, appear to align with a broader consensus among Democratic voters, 2 years ago, Democrats were more likely to sympathize with Israel than with the Palestinians by a 14 percentage point margin, according to a Pew Research Center poll. In January, the same Pew poll showed the cap has shrunk to 2 points. That's significant and the first time I had seen that reported. Matthew Brooks, executive director of the Republican Jewish Coalition, accused Democratic leaders of failing to push back against the, quote, hostile remarks from Democratic candidates. Said Brooks, that involves policing and enforcing their own and making clear that these views are outside the mainstream. So far, they haven't done that, he said. It should be quite clear that Donald Trump's appointees to virtually every cabinet or foreign policy position, not to mention the Supreme Court, have been the worst of any sitting president. But who could have thought, or would have thought, that it would be former Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson, his envoy to NATO, who'd be the one to openly threaten war with Russia? Last Tuesday, ahead of a NATO defense ministers meeting at the alliance headquarters in Brussels, Hutchinson told the world's media that Russia must halt its covert development of a banned cruise missile system, or the United States will seek to destroy it before it becomes operational. The U.S., which has embarked on a $1 trillion program to update its nuclear weapon system, claims Russia is developing a ground launch system in breach of a Cold War treaty that could allow it to launch a nuclear strike on Europe at short notice, a charge that Moscow has consistently denied. Hutchinson said Washington remained committed to a diplomatic solution, but was prepared to consider a military strike if development of the medium-range system continued. At that point, she said, we would be looking at the capability to take out a Russian missile that could hit any of our countries. Countermeasures by the United States, she said, would be to take out the missiles that are in development by Russia in violation of the treaty. They are on notice, she said. So, I would say, are we. In case you might have missed it, Sunday marked the 17th anniversary to the day when the U.S. invaded Afghanistan to depose the Taliban, and on that day at least 54 people, that's Sunday it is, 54 people were killed, 35 members of the country's U.S.-trained security forces, and 19 civilians. Local officials said the majority of the civilian deaths had occurred as a result of firing by government forces in the central part of Afghanistan and by U.S. airstrikes in the eastern part of the country. As could have been expected, spokespersons for the U.S. military, who have been known to have a penchant for lying in these situations, denied that it had conducted airstrikes in the area. The New York Times reported that there are no tangible signs of momentum for peace talks with the Taliban, who, it should be remembered, never attacked us and offered to turn Osama bin Laden over to U.S. forces if Washington provided proof that he was responsible for the attacks of 9/11. The Bush administration preferred war, and those later accused of masterminding the attacks on that day sit in prison in Guantanamo in the U.S.-occupied portion of Cuba, awaiting a trial that will most likely never take place. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.
نخلة تنتطيه فوسا.
This week we sit down for a discussion with Mohammed Eid, who was born and raised in Gaza and worked with the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, teaching in the UN schools in Gaza for several years. He currently is studying at the University of North Carolina and Duke University in the specialized field of crisis management. He's joined by Lori Mosier, who works with UNRWA USA, a private nonprofit organization that raises money to support the work of UNRWA. Mohammed and Lori have been touring U.S. cities, talking about Gaza and the work of UNRWA. We caught up with them when they came to Boston on their tour. Good morning, Mohammed and Lori, and thank you for your willingness to discuss your work with This Week in Palestine. Mohammed, let me begin with you. Please tell us a bit about growing up in Gaza and what led you to your work with UNRWA.
So I grew up in Gaza, in the south of Gaza, in a place called Rafah refugee camp. And what people don't know is that the whole Gaza Strip is categorized as 8 refugee camps by the United Nations. My refugee camp was in the south. It's called Rafah, as I mentioned. So growing up, we have always relied on the UNRWA, on the United Nations. The UNRWA was around us. We could always see that the UNRWA exists. It's a main part of our lives, of daily lives. I could know that because I would join my father for the food package we would have once a month. We would go to the UNRWA center and receive this food package. When I was the age to go to school, the only education facility in that refugee camp was the UNRWA schools. And I wouldn't imagine my father would afford sending me to anywhere else. We didn't have anything, but if I would say he would send me to an education facility outside the camp, he wouldn't be able to afford that. The only reason I had education was because UNRWA was provided for free at the camps.
But what was the quality of that education that you received at the UNRWA school?
I would say it was a very good quality. I wouldn't complain. And it's amazing how it changed since the time I was a student and the time, speaking about these days, how students receive education at the UNRWA schools. UNRWA is implementing a continuous development and in-service training programs. Back then that was in the 90s when I started attending the UNRWA schools. And the place itself was very simple. It was just a small room covered with corrugated metal. And there's no heating still, there's no heating, no air conditioning. Very simple place, very simple chairs. Teachers still using the blackboard and chalk and blackboard. But it was good. The teachers had that belonging to the context. The teachers were people from the refugee camps. We knew them, they knew us. They sometimes would call us sons and daughters. They wouldn't even call us students, or we sometimes call them uncles. That kind of relationship, caretaking relationship, made the school a place of, it's like a grandmother house rather mm-hmm. than, or an uncle house rather than a school or education facility. So it helped us not just develop mental and cognitive capabilities, but also behavioral and emotional capabilities that helped us grow up psychologically in a very good place. So, also I would remember the healthcare facility. It was also 2 minutes walk from my place, and that's where I had all the vaccines when I was young, and all my brothers and all my sisters, and that's where my mom would deliver all my siblings. It was a free healthcare. The UNRWA doesn't charge beneficiaries for anything. And also, I wouldn't imagine what would happen if I did not have access to this free healthcare system. Sometimes because we are in the camps and people didn't have that awareness of the importance of vaccines, the timing of vaccines, we didn't have that communication, we didn't have radio stations, we didn't have TV. So the UNRWA would actually deliver the health services at the schools. So we would go to school and the health team would come to the schools and give the vaccines to students. We would receive them on the health day at the school. Who wouldn't even know that? Our parents wouldn't know that. No one would expect that. And it just happens. The health team comes in, and they provide us with the primary health care, sometimes dentistry check. And we didn't have that complications of school has to reach out for the families first, take permission, sign consent or something like that. The families have already given the schools all the consent, all the permission to do whatever they see as helpful or necessary for the kids. This relationship of high trust has always been the main thing between the UNRWA and the hosting society.
So it sounds like it was a very kind of personal education, and school is a kind of a community place that kids love to go. School, you like to go to school?
I would absolutely say yes. I've always loved to go to school. Summer holiday was very boring. Not because I hated holiday, but because we didn't have much to do during holiday. We would just go out the streets to play in the streets of the camp. So having a school, having a nice place with all the friends, with the nice teachers, with a playground, that was much more appealing for us. So I grew up, and in 2000 was the beginning of the Second Intifada, or the Second War. And my place, the Rafah refugee camp, in my house, I used to live 300 meters away from the buffer zone, or the borders, which is 900 feet. My house is now in the buffer zone. I can't even go there. It doesn't exist anymore. So growing up in that area, I remember I went through tens of nights of military operations in that region. And when I go to sleep, I wouldn't ignore that. You can't just go to sleep and ignore that, because once I put my head on the pillow, I couldn't avoid hearing the tanks. The tanks has a huge engine. The tank itself is over 60 tons, which is 120,000 pounds. It has a huge engine. When it starts running on the borders, you can hear it like more than 2,000, 3,000 feet away. So I go to sleep and I hear the roar of the engines. Then they attack the camps. There will be shooting, there will be bombing. The bulldozers will be destroying some houses, knocking down some houses. And that has a very loud noise, loud sound. We would be scared. We would try to find a place to hide in. If we feel the attack is being very close to us, then we leave the house. The worst part is that we wake up in the morning and we go to school. And the community doesn't have that psychological awareness. No one would talk about it. No one would speak about it. And we go to school, and it's at school when we hear from each other that someone was killed. Mm. And that person we would know, actually. So when we go back home, it will be the funeral, the prayer. We go to attend the service, the prayer, and then we join them to the cemetery. And people get back, and we stay at the funeral house for 3 days. Although we had those rituals, I would say it wasn't enough as a psychological way of addressing such a trauma. Once it's done, once it's passed, everything goes back as it's normal, or as everyone assumes that things should go back normal, but no one talks about it. It was only at the UNRWA schools when teachers started taking that initiative and making those circles and those groups of people, of vulnerable students who come from the crisis zones. And they offered us psychological support. When I think about it, I can't thank them enough, especially that they weren't professionally trained people to do that job. They weren't paid. They weren't asked to do that. It's just they knew someone was going through a shocking experience, and they offered this thing. And me growing up and getting exposed now to how psychological traumas are addressed professionally, I would say they did a very good job. With the games, with sharing stories, circles, with all the exercises they have done, I couldn't thank those people enough. the reason I made it all the way to where I am today, it's because I received all that support when I was a child. So I grew up, my father at some point was offered a job by the UNRWA. His salary in the 90s, his salary started with $400. Mm. And that was a decent salary for that context. That's when I graduated high school. And the UNRWA provides education from grade 1 to grade 9 only. And when I graduated high school, my father could only afford sending me to college because he had that job. If he didn't have that job, and he was supporting my family, family of now we're six people. I have five siblings.
And you went to college, right? In Gaza?
After high school, yes, right, mm-hmm. in Gaza. Mm-hmm. So in Gaza City, which is 1 hour away from
Gaza City, okay.
Yeah, I have to travel every day 1 hour or a little bit more. And I went to the engineering college first, but then. I realized this because the blockade in over Gaza Strip, there were over 4,000 engineers, graduate engineers, with no jobs, unemployed. Mm-hmm. So the education ministry advised students not to study engineering anymore. I dropped out and I joined the education college. I studied English language. And after I graduated, I applied for the UNRWA job program. And thousands of people, I remember at that time, we had 18,000 applicants, and the UNRWA could only offer a place for 120 teachers. The situation was very intense back then. The blockade, the unemployment was very high. So I started working for the UNRWA first thing as a teacher. And it was amazing when I walked into the classrooms, me now being the teacher, who once was the child who would sit there, and everyone would look after him. Everyone would offer him the support and help, and now it's me paying back to the community. So I took that mission seriously. And then part of my inspiration to develop the work, I joined the master program, the graduate program for curriculum design and education development. And that's when I got my first master degree. I also got a second master degree in applied linguistics with focus on language acquisition and language teaching. Unfortunately, by the time I started implementing different initiatives and doing, I joined the education development program at the agency. By the time I was implementing different programs and initiatives and working on improving the work and the strategies, the agency had a very high pressure of paying more attention to the emergency response. So they transferred some of the funds and some of the staff to the emergency response program. I was one of those staff who were transferred. So I started working in 2012 war. I worked for the first time in the emergency response program. And in 2014 military attack, I worked for 50 days for the emergency response program. It's mainly the plan or the strategy was mainly based on a few principles. We prepare for emergencies, we respond to emergencies, and after that we adjust the consequences and fallout of the emergencies. So for speaking about 2014 war, we've prepared for this war, for this conflict, for this attack. We expected that we will have 5,000 refugees. And that was based on the number of schools we had, the number of schools we could use as shelters. So we said, we'll use schools as shelters, open them. We don't have hotels, we don't have shelters, we don't have the infrastructure. And schools are just classrooms, we can use them as a refugee shelter. So we expected 5,000 refugees, stored some food, some water, and whatever services we would need. When the crisis started, I remember we had 5,000 refugees in the first 3-4 days.
Yeah.
By the end of the attack, the 50 days, I remember the UNRWA had 300,000 refugees on site, which is 6 times more than we could host or deal with. I took that job seriously because we have always been saying that you might be the only hope that someone would have, or the only help someone would rely on. Definitely, it's not a dream job. I have chosen myself. I did not consciously grow up dreaming that I want to be an emergency response staff. But now worked in that program and worked in that context and realized how much I change people's lives, how much I contribute to people. To people's safety. I took this job professionally, and what I'm studying now is how to professionally deliver this service.
Well, that's what you're studying at, was it University of Carolina?
Yes.
And Duke?
Yeah. So I'm doing a double major program now. I'm studying global studies and international development with focus in humanitarian effectiveness. And part of my study is how can we deliver humanitarian aid more effectively, how can we address crisis, how we can provide protections, better protection to beneficiaries and refugees.
So you plan on going back to Gaza?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
If the UNRWA still exists in Gaza Strip, which is a matter of now, the updates keep happening every day, if the UNRWA is still operating in Gaza Strip, I'll definitely go back to join the UNRWA staff. If the UNRWA suffers of a huge fund cut or operation cut in Gaza Strip, I would like to take the opportunity before getting back to Gaza Strip and work in different crisis zones around the world, get more experience to enrich the operating or to enrich the mission in Gaza Strip once I'm back.
So you're really doing crisis management, and you're thinking of, before going back to Gaza, going to other sort of emergency spots throughout the world?
Yes. So this is a very important thing. I came to realize that when I joined the university here. Sometimes I share stories, I share strategies and tactics we use in Gaza Strip, which is, as you said, it's called all crisis management, part of the crisis management. And people coming from different contexts, they would share something completely different, and they would say, well, that might not work in our context, or we might try something else, and it worked even better. And it's amazing how people develop these strategies based on the circumstances they live through. And then I met some people who have professionally spent their lives in the emergency response and crisis management, and they had a plan of serving in different crisis zones around the world for the purpose of learning and exchanging experiences between different contexts. I met people who have served in every single crisis zone around the world before they retire. So I thought, this is a professional development plan. Yes, I want to serve humanity first thing in different places. Second thing, I want to do this in a professional and good way. And part of doing this is to go around in different conflict zones, learn, teach, and share my experience.
How long will you be studying in North Carolina? How long before you get your degree?
So the program at North Carolina, the graduate program, is 2 years program. I've already finished 1 year. I'm in my third semester now, one semester left to go, the spring semester. So probably next May or so, July maybe, I'll graduate.
Let's bring Lori into this. Let's talk a bit about UNRWA and maybe how it's supported. You've talked about the role of UNRWA in Gaza, which is the lifeline. Sounds to me it's the lifeline. And now we hear the United States is going to withdraw support, creating enormous problems for the lifeline. So let's talk about it. Lori, talk about what you're doing and a bit. Tell us a bit about UNRWA.
Sure. Well, thank you so much, John, for having us. So UNRWA is mainly funded through nation-state governments who pledge money every year to continue the operations of UNRWA. And historically, the U.S. has been the largest contributor towards UNRWA's annual operating budget since it began operations in 1950. And so this year, in January, the U.S. administration did give UNRWA $60 million, but it froze the remainder of the funding that it had committed to giving this year. And the remainder of that funding is $300 million. And so that started a funding crisis for UNRWA, trying to figure out how to mobilize that funding to be able to continue providing its services through the end of the year. And it wasn't until the end of August that the U.S. administration did announce that they were not going to just freeze that funding, but cut it altogether. And so not just cut the funding for this year, but also future years, for as far as we know, for the rest of this administration. So at this point, UNRWA is trying to do everything that it can to replace the U.S. government funding contribution. Since it was a third of UNRWA's operating budget, it's a huge amount to replace. Typically, UNRWA also starts the beginning of the year at a deficit. So at the beginning of 2018, UNRWA works on a calendar year, there was a deficit of about $450 million, including the U.S. administration's cut. And now, as of a couple weeks ago, we've dropped that down to $64 million in deficit. So UNRWA's made huge strides in trying to close that funding gap. A large portion of that was due to the United Nations General Assembly. There was a ministerial meeting where they raised $122 million, where countries who have already committed to UNRWA stepped up their contributions, increasing them, as well as some new countries also contributing that haven't in the past. So UNRWA's committed to finding those resources to be able to continue funding. But because of the crisis and the cash flow troubles that UNRWA has been trying to manage throughout the year, it has meant a cut in services and a cut in staff in different places of UNRWA's operations.
Including schools?
Schools have not been cut. School education is one of the number one priorities for UNRWA to be able to maintain that service for beneficiaries. So it has been a question of whether or not UNRWA would be able to keep its schools open, but they have been able to open schools on time this year, and it looks like they'll be able to keep them open through the end of the year. Now, next year's budget is another question in terms of where is the money going to come from to replace the U.S. contribution. UNRWA is working very hard on that, with, again, nation state governments trying to increase their contributions and also look elsewhere to be able to replace that funding.
And another problem, of course, is that because of the repeated destruction of Gaza by Israel, a number of the nations that had pledged money to rebuild, help rebuild Gaza, now are withholding that because it's like, I guess they feel it's like throwing money down a rat hole when you build and then it gets destroyed again. And so I think Gaza has that problem also of long-term rehabilitation with this repeated destruction. It is.
I remember the Cairo conference or the Cairo event that took place in 2014, where countries pledged millions of dollars to rebuild Gaza Strip, and when it was time for the UNRWA to implement the program and to receive that fund, those countries have actually asked that Israel commit not to destroy those facilities and infrastructure that will be built. And of course, the response was negative. And the shocking fact is that that money would have gone to build bridges, to build the power station, to build the water station. It was civil infrastructure to serve only civilians. But then there was no commitment of not attacking them again. That's why some of the countries did not commit to their to the donations they have already promised to give, which is at the same time, which at the same time reflect on the people's life. It just adds more misery to the situation, and people suffer more when they don't have those facilities and those services. Of course, the UNRWA has nothing to do with that. They can't do anything. Mm-hmm. The UNRWA, we have always instructed to just keep our focus on the humanitarian efforts, and someone else would be taking care with the political side. So the UNRWA wouldn't discuss politics. They wouldn't even negotiate the terms of donations between those countries and Israel, and making Israel commit to not target them again. Maybe senior officials from the UN might do this mission or this job, but the UNRWA itself is just a humanitarian and a neutral organization focusing only on the humanitarian efforts.
So, Mohammed, tell us about how you got out of Gaza, which is not easy. How did you get out of Gaza to come and study?
to getting out of Gaztep, it might sound surprising, but it took me 100 days. And but even when I say that to my friends, they say, "Oh, that's nothing. You're lucky." It took me 100 days. Throughout the summer, 3 months, I've been trying to get out of Gaza Strip. I have already received unconditional admission from universities. I have done the language test, everything. I needed to get out of Gaza Strip to do the visa interview at the U.S. office in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv. They had one in Jerusalem back then. But then the Israeli army wouldn't allow me. They said, "Arabs from Gaza Strip are not allowed into Jerusalem, neither Tel Aviv." So I started by sending a travel permit. That's what they call it, travel permit, to the Israeli coordination office. And me as individual, I can't do that. I'm not allowed to do it. I have to find an organization, international one, who would send it on my behalf. And they can't do that unless if I was a staff. So my organization, the UNRWA, accepted to send the application on my behalf because my travel was related to my work. My program would be related to my work. They sent the application, and the way they communicate with the Israeli coordination office, it's a one-way communication. They just send applications and wait to hear back. They never talk, they never discuss, they never follow up. They can't even follow up. If they follow up many times, they risk me being put on the blacklist of travel as a kind of punishment.
You're punished, yeah.
Yeah. But then we never heard back, and I was prepared to travel. So I got my fellowship organization involved in the process, and that was Rotary from the United States. So they would reach out from the United States to the Israeli Army Coordination Office and say, "We have students. We have a student. We want to get him out of Gaza Strip, and he have already submitted an application. Just tell us, what is it about? Like, do you have something against him? Is it something we should know about him? Why are you rejecting his application?"
Because you just didn't hear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also they wouldn't get back to them. So eventually after 3 months, that's when it started, when they started getting back to them. And 7 times they said, they reached out to me at night, they said, "Pack your stuff," through my organization. They said, "Pack your stuff and come to the morning to the borders." I did that 7 times. I would go through the investigation, the search, and then by the end of the day they sent me back to Gaza Strip.
What would they say? Why did they send you back? What was their reason?
So I would be, when that happened, I would be sitting in the waiting room or the waiting hall, and someone would walk in. The air is crossing I would be traveling through. It's run by the army. I walk into the air is crossing, and there is tanks, there is soldiers with machine guns everywhere. It's run by the army. A soldier would come with a machine gun. He had my ID card. He would give it to me. He would point to the door that goes to Gaza Strip, and he says, "Go through that door, walk back home." Sometimes I would ask him why, sometimes I wouldn't even dare looking at his face. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't matter.
Completely arbitrary.
He would never answer such question, yeah. Just go back to Gaza Strip. So it was the 8th time when they allowed me to travel. It was very intense, very difficult. And I felt sad when I traveled. I felt sad because I knew people back in Gaza Strip who were really, I'd say, more deserve this opportunity than I am. My friends I know, were admitted to Oxford and to Cambridge universities for the medical college. They would go and study medicine at Cambridge and Oxford, and get back to Gaza Strip and support the health community and the health services. They were some of the most intelligent people I've met in my life. And they never traveled. I left and they were behind. And I was just thinking about them all the time. They deserve this opportunity. I wish if I can give them even mine. Many hundreds of students in Gaza Strip every year receive full sponsored scholarships.
And can't get out.
They can't get out. It just goes away.
Yeah. Incredible.
Yeah. And I can't think why. Education... When I worked for the UNRWA, they had a slogan for the education department, which is "Peace starts here," because the UNRWA believed that peace really starts with the education. I don't know how does that help having a education blockade over Gaza Strip? Whom does that serve anyway? It's always better to work and negotiate and deal with people who are highly educated. The community needs education. The community needs development. It doesn't make any sense destroying the community on all aspects, on all levels, in such a way as it happens in Palestine.
Let me ask another question, another issue in Gaza, and that is the political issue. Gaza not only has a struggle with Israel, but has a struggle between Hamas and Fatah, the whole political dynamic. Where do you see that going?
So, unfortunately, and Palestine in general, it's not like the other Arab countries. It doesn't have this strong dictatorship. It never had them. Luckily, we don't have the strong dictatorships, and we don't have the strong radical extreme groups, as we saw in Iraq and Syria and other contexts. So, we had the experience with electing or voting for the Hamas party to rule in Gaza Strip. And immediately, as Hamas took the government, Israel enforced the blockade over Gaza Strip and sanctioned the Palestinian Authority because they allowed an Islamic movement or allowed Hamas to get into the government. So the whole situation got mixed up, and that helped actually keep Hamas in power more than 4 years, because elections would take place every 4 years. But when we got separated, geographically separated, the government was sanctioned. Everything got mixed up. Since then, we couldn't read the national elections. Me, personally speaking, I would love to practice my right again to choose someone else to rule over Gaza Strip. And that's the democratic problem, the democratic process, that's the democracy, that's the game. You elect someone, you vote for someone, and then after 4 years, you vote for someone else. Hamas and Gaza Strip, although I disagree very much with the Hamas way of ruling Gaza Strip and running Gaza Strip, I'm happy and proud to say that I did not vote for Hamas in the first place because I was young, I couldn't vote. But my family, none of my family voted for them. Not my father, not my mother, none of us voted for them. Even if they voted, I wouldn't. They just practiced their political right. But the thing I'd like to mention is that people have been criticizing Hamas so much in Gaza Strip. People have been talking up against Hamas. And because Hamas couldn't go for national elections, the only thing they would do was that, fine, we'll dismantle the government, give away everything, and whoever wants to take over is more than welcome to do that. And that's what happened. The government, we had something, not government, but it's called Administrative Committee, which was run by Hamas officials or politicians who were elected. Eventually was dismantled, and they gave in to Fatah. They said, Gaza Strip is all yours, the government is all yours, we can't take criticism anymore. What happened is that when Fatah was about to take over Gaza Strip, come back to Gaza Strip, immediately the Israeli government said that we will not transfer money to Palestinian Authority if you go to Gaza Strip and do the unity with Gaza Strip between the Gaza and West Bank. So Palestinian Authority survives on the international aid and the money that comes through the Israeli banks and the Israeli government. So they stopped the whole reconciliation process, and then Gaza Strip now is left with no one to run. Simply put, there's no one running Gaza Strip right now. Hamas has no interest to take all this responsibility, all this criticism. Hamas started out as a charity movement, helping people, giving them money, giving them aid. They don't want to risk all this reputation they had through the years. They have been trying their best to just provide simple aid, to provide some relief to the community. And the community is still angry with the Hamas movement, but they're in a very bad situation. They have given away everything, and no one wants to take Gaza Strip, unfortunately.
Well, let me ask this broad question. It's one I guess we ask each other all the time about Gaza, and that is, given the current reality, where's the hope, or is there hope? What kind of vision do people have for a way out of this, or is there one? What's your take on where we go?
Well, the hope doesn't lie far away from where we're sitting right now. It's actually in this country. I put it this simply. The only solution would be the international pressure, the international role. The largest U.S. aid in the whole of the U.S. history goes to Israel in military aid. Military aid, literally, that simple. The largest support Israel have is from the United States. The largest number of times, the most times the U.S. administration used the veto in the United Nations was for Israel, to protect Israel. If the U.S. administration decides that we will address this crisis neutrally, we would focus on the humanitarian side, which is the first step. This is what I've been studying and this is what we have been discussing. The first step, if the U.S. says this is a humanitarian crisis, not a political one, first step, we want to open humanitarian access, humanitarian gate or bridge to the Palestinian crisis, address all the humanitarian needs. That's number one. Number two, we should stop all acts of violence, all the acts of warfare that are happening over there. And number three, we start focusing on development, investment, and integrating geographically. We can't separate Palestine and Israel. Integrating investments on both Israel and Palestinian corporations and businesses in Palestine. Once we start with these steps, number four would be politics, speaking politics. And then in that scenario, you can't, all the studies about conflict resolution, all the political research says to you, it's very easy to work on reconciliation, to work on politics, when you have people interdependent on each other, when you have people dependent on each other, you have businesses dependent on each other, people are unlikely to disagree with someone who helps them, who helps running their business or makes their business successful. So focusing on three things, which is the main four aspects of the international development, stability, humanitarian aid, development, and the fourth thing I would add, which is human rights, addressing those four steps by a government or by a very powerful state like the U.S. administration would definitely solve the problem. Sooner than you would imagine. I wouldn't be very ambitious and give you, I'd say, a few days, but literally, it's so powerful there.
Yeah, I agree. I think, to a large extent, we're the problem, and we can be the solution in this country.
Absolutely.
I think, to a large extent, we're the problem, and we can be the solution in this country.
Absolutely. Yeah. It can be a major part of the solution.
Mm. Well, Mohammed, thank you very much. This has been incredible, and Lori, you know, to get this kind of insight and to get this kind of narrative, this is what we do. Let people talk. Let Palestinians talk. Tell your story. So, and you're on a kind of a tour around the country now. You're going to be speaking again in Boston. So we wish you much success on your tour.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time and appreciate you giving me the platform to reach out to people and share my story. And I would thank the U.S. community, the American community. As you mentioned, I've been on a tour, kind of, and the community has been very hospitable. They have been very nice, very kind, very understanding, very willing to know and listen. So I ask, and very supportive. They have been giving donations to the UNRWA USA, helping keeping schools open, helping the aid program, helping sustain the aid programs. So I thank them, honestly, from the bottom of my heart. This is very amazing, very touching. And thank you very much for everything.
Thank you. You have been listening to Mohammed Eid from Gaza. and Lori Mosier, representing UNRRA USA. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. If that is too early for you on a Sunday morning, you can hear the program later in the day or at any other time of the week via the archive found on the WZBC homepage. Simply click on Archive, go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. However, each program is on this archive for only 2 weeks. After 2 weeks, to reach our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. It is all there. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
when the consent of the governed becomes a joke, despots fill the political void. They give vent to popular anger and frustration while arming the state to do to the majority what it has long done to the minority. This tale is as old as civilization. It was played out in ancient Greece and Rome, the Soviet Union, fascist Germany, fascist Italy, and the former Yugoslavia. Once a tiny cabal seizes power, monarchist, communist, fascist, or corporate, it creates a mafia economy and a mafia state. The crisis we face is the result of a four-decade-long slow-motion corporate coup d'etat that has left corporations and the war machine omnipotent. The problem is the corporate state, and until we dismantle that, we are doomed.
You're listening to episode 749 of Unwelcome Guests, on the rise and fall of US corporatocracy. I'm Robin Upton, and that was Chris Hedges, who's going to be speaking on the state of life in the US in 2017. And we're going to hear mostly on the rise of corporatocracy, on how the deep state, the small cabal who took over control of the US government, how they systematically dismantled bits of society that they didn't want, specifically democratic government and the family, a bit on the fall of the US corporatocracy. It's still to happen slightly, so we're going to have a look at historical parallels about how the same pattern has been repeated throughout history. We're going to be looking at particularly the last 40 years, the policies in US society, largely unremarked upon by the distraction that is corporate politics. Let's get a historical perspective. We're going to hear about the fascist coup in the early 1930s, which was foiled by the integrity of General Smedley Butler. This is called the business plot, such as it exists on Wikipedia. You could find out a little bit about it. There's not much more, I'm afraid, on Wikispooks. It's worth looking at. And it references episode 229 of this show, which you could try if you wanted more details. Thanks to Tony Gosling for posting this MP3, which I found on Radio for All. And that was this year. I don't know where it's from, I'm afraid. And it does finish rather abruptly, but it is nevertheless a good introduction to one of the little forgotten corners of US history, which you're not going to hear about in government schools.
On the 21st of November 1934, the following rather chilling article appeared in the New York Times. It concerns the discovery of a planned coup that could have altered the course of American history. Yet today, hardly anyone knows anything about it.
A plot of Wall Street interest to overthrow President Roosevelt and establish a fascist dictatorship, backed by a private army of 500,000 ex-soldiers and others, appeared before the House of Representatives Committee on Un-American Activities, which began hearings on the charges.
If these long-forgotten accounts can be relied on, I seem to be looking at an attempt to set up a fascist government in the land of the free. A coup that could have toppled one of America's most revered presidents, paved the way for a possible alliance with Italy and Germany, and thereby changed the complexion of World War II.
Fascism was seen as an example to be learned from, because it seemed like a quick fix. All you needed to do was get people to shape up.
You could have had a handful of the wealthiest people in the United States found guilty of treason and sentenced to death.
But just what was this plot? Who were the Wall Street interests? Or was this nothing more than a moment of paranoia from a national media not renowned for its self-restraint? Well, the answers to some of these questions may have to wait until I can get my hands on the bulk of the evidence, documents detailing evidence heard behind closed doors by a congressional committee. But I already have the official statement released by that committee when it reported back to Congress. Its members clearly had no doubt that a fascist coup was in the offing.
In the last few weeks of the committee's official life, it received evidence showing that certain persons had made an attempt to establish a fascist organization in this country. There is no question that these attempts were discussed, were planned, and might have been placed in execution when and if the financial backers deemed it expedient.
So, such a plot, backed by powerful people, was waiting in the wings. That much is very clear. But how did it come to this? Well, it all happened during one of the bleakest moments in U.S. history.
They used to tell me I was building a dream.
The America of 1933 was in the teeth of the Great Depression, a time of extreme poverty, desperation, and the barren plains of the Grapes of Wrath.
Brother, can you spare a dime?
I see millions of families trying to live on income so meager that the pall of family disaster hangs over them day by day.
Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
The Great Depression is not called the Great Depression in this country by accident.
Michael Kazin is professor of history at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C.
It was the deepest and the longest economic downturn in American history. As many as one-third of the labor force was unemployed in the early 1930s especially. The core of the industrial economy was all but shut down.
Say, buddy, can you spare a dime?
All of this added to a sense that American society was coming apart, not just the economy. People no longer had much faith in the authorities at any level, economic or political.
Yet the image of those days we've been left with is not social unrest, fascism and treasonous plots, but one of dignified suffering and resilient faith in the American dream. No one illustrated that better than President Franklin D. Roosevelt, whose New Deal reforms promised jobs, pride and fresh hope to ordinary Americans.
I, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States, and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So help me God.
FDR's New Deal policies brought an increase in public work programs, more help for the poor, and the removal of the dollar from the gold standard. Yet while history remembers FDR as a visionary savior in America's hour of need, some at the time saw him in a very different light.
There were major elements of the business community that hated Roosevelt. And they hated Roosevelt out of all proportion to the scale of the measures that he had actually brought in.
Professor Tony Badger is Master of Clare College, Cambridge, and author of several books on Roosevelt's New Deal.
These were businessmen who essentially thought that Roosevelt was putting America on the wrong road in a big way in 1933, and that it was setting the federal government up as a sort of arbiter and enforcer and intervener in the American economy in a way that they were deeply afraid of.
Such powerful enemies had been made within 100 days of FDR taking office in 1933.
The businessmen were also aware that out in the country there were demagogues who were making really popular, apparently radical-sounding appeals, and they were always worried that Roosevelt was unleashing these forces, would encourage these, what they thought of as crackpots, to wreak havoc.
The right wing in America wasn't going to sit back and let this happen. Although its members were a curious alliance of rich and poor, North and South, they were united by one central concern. America was changing in a way they didn't like. Professor Kazin.
The idea that the government would create jobs, the idea that these jobs would be given to all religious groups and all racial groups was very threatening. And so a lot of people who didn't like what Roosevelt seemed to be doing with the government didn't like it, partly because the very people who were cheering Roosevelt were people who this still majority of white Protestant Americans believed should not have any power at all in government, should be subservient.
American society was fracturing along racial lines as well as political ones, and the right was sensing a new power.
There were insurgencies we could call sort of proto-fascist, groups called the Silver Legion, the Silver Shirts, the Black Legion. Most of these groups were continuing some of the themes of the Ku Klux Klan, and these groups often carried out vigilante violence against Catholic workers, Black workers in some of the factories in the North. These groups had great aspirations to become much larger than they were. Some of them had aspirations to imitate what had happened in Italy and was happening in Germany.
It's into this world that the plot to overthrow FDR was born. But who was going to lead it, and how did they think they'd get away with it? I'm hoping the answers lie amongst the formerly secret papers of the Congressional Committee that investigated the planned coup. These, I'm told, are locked away in the National Archives of America, a few hundred yards from the White House in downtown Washington.
Well, this seems to be it, the National Archives Research Center. Fantastically grand building. Looks like there's strict security in operation here. Airport scanner machine. Hello, I'm from the BBC. I've got an appointment with archivist Jessica Kratz.
Okay. Hold on 1 sec, let me give her a call.
Thank you very much.
Jessica led me down increasingly claustrophobic corridors into the heart of the archive.
This is staff area. Legislative records, here, watch your head.
The documents I'm after are from a committee known as the McCormack-Dickstein Committee, after the two men who chaired it.
So here are the papers, the official committee papers. They're kind of organized by, you know, this file code here, HR 73A-F.
And Special Committee on Un-American Activities on Nazi Propaganda.
It was established to investigate the activities of fascist sympathizers in the U.S. in the early years of Roosevelt's presidency.
It's a very small amount. Only, what, four and a half boxes for what they did in executive session.
So it doesn't look that much, and there's even less than it looks.
For what the committee investigated and how much testimony they heard, yes, I mean, it's a very small amount.
Despite the paucity of documents, there are some that catch my eye.
Starts with some interesting disputes between the general and the committee. The chairman, General, you are a retired commandant of the Marine Corps.
The most important testimony in these records is from a senior commander of the U.S. Marines, Major General Smedley Butler.
I was in the Marine Corps 33 years and 4 months on the active list.
Major General Butler came before the committee of his own free will. He had, he said, been contacted by a well-connected New York City broker called Gerald McGuire. McGuire met Butler a number of times and slowly revealed his audacious plan. He and his financial backers wanted Butler, a highly decorated war hero, hugely respected by rank-and-file soldiers, to rouse an army of World War I veterans, many of whom were angry that a bonus they'd been promised had yet to be paid. The idea was that the general would use these men to help seize the White House, just like Hitler and Mussolini had used their private armies to bully their way into power. At the time, Butler, a staunch defender of democracy, went along with the plan, but he was secretly appalled. Inside the National Archives, I was joined by writer John Buchanan, who has made a study of right-wing America in the 1930s.
These super wealthy capitalists essentially wanted to pose such a threat to Roosevelt that he would basically step aside. If FDR would not cooperate and step aside, they would execute him, kill him.
Smedley Butler's testimony shows the plot was at an advanced stage.
McGuire said to me, "I went abroad to study the part that the veterans play in the various setups of the governments that they have abroad, like France, and I found just exactly the organization we're going to have. It is an organization of 500,000 super soldiers. Here in America." "Well," I said, "I suppose you get these 500,000 men in America. What are you going to do with them?" He said, Did it ever occur to you that the president is overworked? We might have an assistant president. He went on to say that the position would be a secretary of general affairs, a sort of super secretary. He said, you know the American people will swallow that. We have got the newspapers. We will start a campaign that the president's health is failing. Everybody can tell that by looking at him, and the dumb American people will fall for it in a second.
Now in his 90s, Jules Archer was a young man of 18 when General Smedley Butler gave his testimony. He remembers just how idolized the man still was by the tens of thousands of veterans who'd been under his command.
He was a fantastic anti-war general. He was very popular with the soldiers and sailors. He fought for them, and he fought for their rights. That was one of the reasons he was selected for the plot, because they knew he could raise a paramilitary army of veterans who would follow him because they believed in him.
It was here at the Association of the Bar in central New York City, just a stone's throw from Wall Street, that the case against the plotters came to a head. The chief witness, Major General Smedley Butler, walked up these steps past the giant stone pillars that tower above me here and through the rather elegant doors. Even today, all the officers on either side of me, behind the large wooden doors, are packed with people who are going through today's important legal cases. But back on Tuesday, the 20th of November, 1934, this was perhaps the most serious case the country could possibly have faced. And the room where it all took place is up several flights of stairs in what's known as the supper room.
One of the most important witnesses who came here was Paul Cumley French, a journalist Smedley Butler took into his confidence after the conspirators had tried to recruit him. French had also met chief plotter Gerald Maguire at his Wall Street offices, and he recounted their conversation to the committee.
We need a fascist government in this country, he insisted, to save the nation from the communists who want to tear it down and wreck all that we have built in America. The only men who have the patriotism to do it are the soldiers, and Smedley Butler is the ideal leader. He could organize 1 million men overnight. During the course of the conversation, he continually discussed the need of a man on a white horse, as he called it, a dictator who would come galloping in on his white horse. He said that was the only way, to save the capitalistic system.
But it was Smedley Butler, war hero and soldier's friend, who exposed the plot. He continued his meetings with Maguire until he gathered enough information on the plotters to bring the evidence before the McCormack-Dickstein Committee. But given that there were no recordings of these meetings or letters written by Maguire outlining his plans, how can we be sure that the general didn't exaggerate or even make up the whole story? Jules Archer, who went on to study the lives of Smedley Butler and Representative John McCormack, is convinced the plot was real. He remembers talking to McCormack about his time as chairman of the committee that investigated the case.
McCormack was a veteran politician. He was an advisor to Roosevelt and other presidents. He had a heavy Irish accent. He told me General Smedley Butler was one of the outstanding Americans in our history. I cannot emphasize too strongly the very important part he played in exposing the fascist plot in the early 1930s, backed by and planned by persons possessing tremendous wealth. And there was no doubt about it that McCormack was absolutely convinced that Butler was telling the truth.
An announcer has talked on an active movement in the United States. He presents Representative
In this early radio archive, you can just make out the other co-chairman, Representative Samuel Dickstein, warning Americans to be aware of the threat from fascist forces from within.
We have succeeded in unearthing evidence to define the Nazi government here as the most dangerous threat to our democracy that has ever existed.
And the central character of the plot, the plain-speaking Major General Smedley Butler, was caught on early newsreel from the time, explaining his part in exposing the plot.
I talked with an investigator for this committee. He told me they had unearthed evidence linking my name with several such veteran organizations. As it then seemed to me to be getting serious, I felt it was my duty to tell all I knew of such activities to this committee. My main interest in all this is to preserve our democratic institution.
So Smedley Butler remained adamant that he was the target of a fascist plot, and there was never any doubt either in the mind of committee chairman John McCormack that the forces of fascism were gathering to storm the White House. But who was going to fund the coup? Even with the backing of 500,000 veterans, a plot of this sort against the most powerful government on earth needs money as well as muscle, and an awful lot of it too. Well, according to Smedley Butler, this was where the big business moguls and Wall Street brokers behind the coup came in. They, he was told by Maguire, would soon step out of the shadows in the form of a newly created lobby group. Soon after he made this promise to Butler, the American Liberty League was born. John Buchanan.
Maguire said, well, you're going to see in the next few weeks in the press, this organization is going to be created that's going to front for the whole thing, and we're going to stand up for the Constitution, and we're going to stand up for our troops and so on. And lo and behold, about 2 weeks later, splashed all over the major newspapers of the time, especially in New York and Washington, the creation of the American Liberty League.
To get a flavor of the ideology that motivated the Liberty League, here's one of their leading supporters, Demarest Lloyd, writing in his magazine, Affairs.
Popular government is a perilous extravagance in time of emergency. The present situation is more destructive than war, and much more difficult for a popular government to handle. It is quite apparent that unless confusion is to become chaos, Congress, like a long line of unfit rulers in the past, should abdicate.
It's a matter of record that the membership of the American Liberty League included some of the most famous names in business. Its benefactors read like a who's who of household products that are still familiar today. General Foods, the makers of Maxwell House coffee, Birdseye and Colgate, Heinz Foods, U.S. Steel and car manufacturer General Motors were all supporters of the League.
These are industrial individual titans of industry, and they talked to each other and they wound each other up into ever-increasing frenzy and denunciation of the men in the White House. They become quite a fevered, conspiracy-oriented group of individuals. They are the people who go on to form the American Liberty League.
The treasurer of this organisation was the broker Grayson Murphy. Little research has revealed that he was none other than the boss of the man at the centre of the plot allegations, Gerald Maguire. Later in the McCormack-Dickstein report, a shipping company called Hamburg America Line was accused of providing free passage to Germany to American journalists willing to write favourable copy on Hitler's rise to power. The company is also alleged to have brought Nazi spies and pro-fascist sympathisers into America. John Buchanan has studied this later section of the report and has discovered that one of the company's managers came from a very famous family.
The thing that surprised me most was to discover in the documents that this company, Hamburg America Lines, had in fact been managed on the U.S. side at the executive level by Prescott Bush, as part of a web of Nazi business interests that were all seized in late 1942 under the Trading with the Enemy Act by the U.S. Congress. And Prescott Bush is the grandfather of the sitting president of the United States.
Of course, at the time, it was perfectly legal to have dealings with Hitler's Germany. Prescott Bush was not called to account for this until America entered the war. Neither was it a crime to be a member of a lobby group like the Liberty League, and I found no firm evidence that the Liberty League itself was behind the plot to overthrow their country's democratically elected president. But academics like Professor Tony Badger believes that it was, at the very least, a magnet for those with such intentions.
It would always surprise me if they had been really, there had been a lot of very fine-tuned planning. But the sense that forces that might be unleashed by the New Deal posed such a threat that desperate measures might be needed, it does ring true.
But yet again, the evidence is hard to find. You'd have thought that if there was any linking leading American industrialists of the day to a plot against the president, I'd be able to find it at the National Archives in Washington. Yet when John Buchanan and I leafed through the rather thin files there, we found no direct reference to any of these people. Though I'm now starting to wonder whether any such evidence has been removed or deliberately withheld from the records in the first place. General Butler seemed to have harboured similar suspicions. After the investigating committee published its findings, he accused its members of deliberately editing out of his testimony the names of top business people who he'd linked to the plot. On the 17th of February 1935, just after the committee had published its findings, he had this to say on Radio WCAU.
Like most committees, it has slaughtered the little and allowed the big to escape. The big shots weren't even called to testify. They were all mentioned in the testimony. Why was all mention of these names suppressed from the testimony?
The co-chairman, Samuel Dickstein, admits that the papers were censored, but insisted that this was for a very good reason.
The testimony given by General Butler was kept confidential until such time as the names of the persons who were mentioned could be checked upon and verified. This accounts for the fact that when the results of the hearings were made public, references were omitted.
That argument would have seemed fair enough if names had later been checked and verified. Yet most of the senior figures implicated in General Smedley Butler's evidence were never asked to appear before the committee to answer the questions raised. Even though, had the allegations against them been found to be true, people like Irene DuPont and banker J.P. Morgan could have faced the death sentence for treason.
The investigations mysteriously turn to vapor when it comes time to call them to testify. FDR's main interest was getting the New Deal passed. And so he struck a deal in which it was agreed that the plotters would walk free if Wall Street would back off of their opposition to the New Deal and let FDR do what he wanted.
John Buchanan. With their cover blown, it seems likely that the plotters and their wealthy backers had little option but to accept such a deal and return to the business they knew best, making money. But what chance would such a coup have had anyway? Even with millions of dollars and 500,000 veterans at their disposal, could the plotters ever have pulled it off against the armed forces of a great power like the US? Well, according to Professor Tony Badger, back then it might not have been quite as difficult as it now seems.
The American army was anything but powerful in 1933. A peacetime army had been reduced to, 130,000, scattered all over the United States. It was a depressing and soul-destroying business being an army officer in the United States in the 1920s and 1930s. So I think the sense that the American army as such was a powerful group that could have put down any trouble has to be seen in that context.
Though Professor William Becker of George Washington University insists that defeating the Federal Army would only be the first of many big challenges still facing the coup leaders.
I just remain extremely skeptical about this because the U.S. government was, in fact, very, very decentralized. When one talks about, you know, seizing power, I just think it would be extremely difficult given the decentralized nature of the government. There would have been enormous resistance to that.
Professor William Becker. Perhaps the biggest remaining question is whether, had the coup gone ahead and been successful, the American people would ever have put up with a dictator in the White House. It seems unlikely. After all, this is a nation that describes itself as the land of the free, the home of democracy. But Professor Michael Kazin is not quite so dismissive. He believes that if we today are ready to accept the loss of some of our liberties in return for personal security, might Americans of the Great Depression have been just as ready to sacrifice some of their freedoms for food, jobs, and financial security?
People wanted security. I mean, the key word in the 30s, as now for that matter, was security. Social security, of course, health security. And Americans, I think, in the 30s cared more about security than they did about democracy. And so if a group of businessmen, with the help of some people, former military people or current military people, could have fairly quickly brought the economy back, created the sense of security, then yes, it is possible that, they would have gotten some popular support.
America would have become a dictatorship. Democracy would have been gone. America would have joined Hitler and Mussolini as a fascist triumvirate.
Now, we continue with Unwelcome Guests Regular. This is Chris Hedges. I've posted a video of this presentation online at our webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/749. He's speaking in Portland in 2017 at the KABU Stop Fascism event. And I've trimmed a little bit of hesitation and audience applause to fit this within the required time frame.
The decision by the deep state in ancient Rome, like the United States in 2017, dominated by a bloated military and corrupt oligarchy, to strangle the Emperor Commodus in his bath in the year 192, did not halt the growing chaos and precipitous decline of the Roman Empire. Commodus, like a number of other late Roman empires, and like Donald Trump, was incompetent and consumed by his own vanity. He commissioned innumerable statues of himself as Hercules and had little interest in governance. He used his position as head of state to make himself the star of his own ongoing public show. He fought victoriously as a gladiator in the arena in fixed bouts. Power for Commodus, as it is for Trump, was primarily about catering to his bottomless narcissism, hedonism, and lust for wealth. He sold public offices so the ancient equivalents of Betsy DeVos and Steve Mnuchin could orchestrate a vast kleptocracy. Commodus was replaced by the reformer Pertinax, the Bernie Sanders of his day, who attempted to curb the unchecked power of the Praetorian Guards, the ancient version of the military-industrial complex. This effort saw the Praetorian Guards assassinate Pertinax after 3 months in office. The Guards then auctioned off the office of emperor to the highest bidder. The next emperor, Didius Julianus, lasted 66 days. There would be 5 emperors in 193 AD, the year after the assassination of Commodus. Trump and our decaying empire have ominous historical precedents. If the deep state replaces Trump, whose ineptitude and imbecility are embarrassing to the empire, that action will not restore our democracy any more than replacing Commodus restored the Republic to Rome. The choice is between inept fascists like Trump and competent fascists like Pence. Our republic is dead. The idiots, seeing in the decay the chance for personal advancement and profit, take over in the final days of crumbling civilizations. Idiot generals wage endless, unwinnable wars that bankrupt the nation. Idiot economists call for reducing taxes for the rich and cutting social service programs for the poor, and project economic growth on the basis of myth. Idiot industrialists poison the water, the soil, and the air, slash jobs, and depress wages. Idiot bankers gamble on self-created financial bubbles and impose crippling debt peonage on the citizens. Idiot journalists and public intellectuals pretend despotism is democracy. Idiot intelligence operatives orchestrate the overthrowing of foreign governments to create lawless enclaves that give rise to enraged fanatics. And idiot professors, experts, and specialists busy themselves with unintelligible jargon and arcane theory that buttress the policies of the rulers. Idiot entertainers and producers create lurid spectacles of sex, gore, and fantasy. There is a familiar checklist for extinction. We are ticking off every item on it. The idiots know only one word, more. They are unencumbered by common sense. They hoard wealth and resources until workers cannot make a living and the infrastructure collapses. They live in privileged compounds where they eat chocolate cake and order missile strikes. They see the state as a projection of their own vanity. The Roman, Mayan, French, Habsburg, Ottoman, Romanov, Wilhelmine, Pahlavi, and Soviet dynasties crumbled because the whims and obsessions of ruling idiots were law. Trump is the face of our collective idiocy. He is what lies behind the mask of our professed civility and rationality, a sputtering, narcissistic, bloodthirsty megalomaniac. This face in the past was hidden, at least to most white Americans, but with the destruction of democratic institutions and the disempowerment of the citizen, the oligarchs and the kleptocrats have become brazen. They no longer need to pretend. They steal and lie openly. They wield armies and fleets against the wretched of the earth, blithely ignore the looming catastrophe caused by global warming, and cannibalize the nation, while at night, like some monster from the Grand Guignol, the idiot in chief, overseeing our self-immolation, sits slack-jawed in front of a television set before opening his beautiful Twitter account. Forget the firing of James Comey. Forget the paralysis in Congress. Forget the inanity of a press that covers our descent into tyranny as if it were a sports contest between corporate Republicans and corporate Democrats or a reality show starring our maniacal president. Forget the noise. The crisis we face is not embodied in the public images of the politicians that run our dysfunctional government. The crisis we face is the result of a four-decade-long slow-motion corporate coup d'etat that has left corporations and the war machine omnipotent, turned our electoral system into legalized bribery, and elevated public figures who master the arts of entertainment and artifice. Trump is the symptom. He is not the disease. Our descent into despotism began with the pardoning of Richard Nixon, all of whose impeachable crimes are now legal. And the extrajudicial assault, including targeted assassinations and imprisonment, carried out on dissidents and radicals, especially black radicals. This assault, done in the name of law and order, put the organs of internal security, from the FBI to Homeland Security, beyond the reach of the law. It began with the creation of corporate-funded foundations and organizations that took control of the press, the courts, the universities, scientific research, and the two major political parties. It began with empowering militarized police to kill unarmed citizens and the spread of a horrendous system of mass incarceration and the death penalty. It began with the stripping away of our most basic constitutional rights, privacy, due process, habeas corpus, fair elections, and dissent. It began when big money was employed by political operatives such as Roger Stone, a close advisor to Trump, who created negative political advertisements and spread malicious gossip and false narratives, all eagerly amplified by a media devoted to profits and ratings rather than truth, to deceive the public until political debate became burlesque. The ruling elites, terrified by the mobilization of the left in the 1960s, or by what the political scientist Samuel Huntington called America's excess of democracy, built counter-institutions to delegitimize and marginalize critics of corporate capitalism and imperialism. They bought the allegiances of the two main political parties. They imposed obedience to the neoliberal ideology within academia and the press. This campaign, laid out by Lewis Powell in his 1971 memorandum titled Attack on American Free Enterprise System, was the blueprint for the creeping coup d'etat that 45 years later is complete. Our failure to defend the rights of those who are demonized and persecuted leaves us all demonized and persecuted. Our failure to demand justice for everyone leaves us all without justice. Our failure to halt the crushing of popular movements that stand unequivocally with the oppressed leaves us all oppressed. Our failure to protect our democracy leaves us without a democracy. The persecution of the radicals of four decades ago is not ancient history. It is the genesis of the present. It spawned the corporate coup and the machinery of state terror. We will pay for our complacency. We are trapped like rats in a cage. A con artist may be turning the electric shocks on and off, but the problem is the corporate state. And until we dismantle that, we are doomed. Racist, violent, and despotic forces have always been part of the American landscape. They have often been tolerated and empowered by the state to persecute poor people of color and dissidents. These forces are denied absolute power as long as a majority of citizens have a say in their own governance. But once citizens are locked out of government and denied a voice, power shifts into the hands of the enemies of the open society. When democratic institutions cease to function, when the consent of the governed becomes a joke, despots fill the political void. They give vent to popular anger and frustration while arming the state to do to the majority what it has long done to the minority. This tale is as old as civilization. It was played out in ancient Greece and Rome, the Soviet Union, fascist Germany, fascist Italy, and the former Yugoslavia. Once a tiny cabal seizes power, monarchist, communist, fascist, or corporate, it creates a mafia economy and a mafia state. Trump and his coterie of billionaires, generals, half-wits, Christian fascists, criminals, racists, and deviants play the role of the Snopes clan in some of William Faulkner's novels. The Snopeses fill the power vacuum of the decayed South and ruthlessly seized control from the degenerated former slaveholding aristocratic elites. Phlegm Snopes and his extended family, which includes a killer, a pedophile, a bigamist, an arsonist, a mentally disabled man who copulates with a cow, and a relative who sells tickets to witness the bestiality, are fictional representations of the moral rot unleashed by unfettered capitalism. The usual reference to amorality, while accurate, is not sufficiently distinctive and by itself does not allow us to place them as they should be placed in a historical moment, the critic Irving Howe wrote of the Snopeses. Perhaps the most important thing to be said is that they are what comes afterwards, the creatures that emerge from the devastation with the slime still upon their lips. Let a world collapse in the South or Russia, and there appear figures of coarse ambition, driving their way up from beneath the social bottom, men to whom moral claims are not so much absurd as incomprehensible, sons of bushwhackers and musics drifting in from nowhere, and taking over through the sheer outrageousness of their monolithic force. They become presidents of local banks and chairmen of party regional committees, and later, a trifle slicked up, they muscle their way into Congress or the Politburo. Scavengers without inhibition. They need not believe in the crumbling official code of their society. They need only learn to mimic its sounds. Societies that had democratic traditions are easy prey for the enemies of democracy. Demagogues pay deference to the patriotic ideals, rituals, and practices and forms of the open society while they dismantle it. When the Roman Emperor Augustus, he referred to himself as the first citizen, neutered the Republic, he was careful to maintain the form of the old Republic. Lenin and the Bolsheviks did the same when they seized and crushed the autonomous Soviets. Even the Nazis and the Stalinists insisted they ruled democratic states. Despotic government, as Thomas Paine wrote, is a fungus that grows out of a corrupt civil society. This is what happened to these older democracies. It is what happened to us. Corporations are legally empowered to exploit and loot. It is impossible to vote against the interests of Goldman Sachs or ExxonMobil. The pharmaceutical and insurance industries are legally empowered to hold sick children hostage while their parents frantically bankrupt themselves trying to save their sons or daughters. Banks are legally empowered to burden people with student loans that cannot be forgiven by declaring bankruptcy. The animal agriculture industry is legally empowered in many states to charge those who attempt to publicize the conditions in the vast factory farms where diseased animals are warehoused for slaughter with a criminal offense. Corporations are legally empowered to carry out tax boycotts. Free trade deals legally empower global corporations to destroy small farmers and businesses and deindustrialize the country. Government agencies designed to protect the public from contaminated air, water, and food, and from usurious creditors and lenders have been gutted. The Supreme Court, in an inversion of rights worthy of George Orwell, defines unlimited corporate contributions to electoral campaigns as the right to petition the government and a form of free speech. The press, owned by corporations, is an echo chamber for the elites. State and city enterprises and utilities are sold off to corporations that hike rates and deny services. The educational system is being privatized and turned into a species of rote vocational training. Wages are stagnant or have declined. Unemployment and underemployment, masked by falsified statistics, have thrust half the country into chronic poverty. Social services are abolished in the name of austerity. Culture and the arts have been replaced by sexual commodification, banal entertainment, and graphic depictions of violence. The infrastructure, neglected and underfunded, is collapsing. Bankruptcies, foreclosures, food shortages, and untreated illnesses that lead to early death plague a harried underclass. The desperate flee into an underground economy dominated by drugs, crime, and human trafficking. The state, rather than address the economic misery, militarizes police departments and empowers them to use lethal force against unarmed citizens. It fills the prisons with 2.3 million people, only a tiny percentage of whom ever got a trial. And 1 million prisoners now work for corporations inside prisons as modern-day slaves, paid pennies on the dollar without any rights or protection. They are the corporate state's ideal worker. The amendments of the Constitution designed to protect the citizen from tyranny are meaningless. The Fourth Amendment, for example, reads, "The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized." The reality is that our telephone calls, emails, texts, and financial, judicial, and medical records, along with every website we visit, and our physical travels are tracked, recorded, and stored in perpetuity in government computer banks. The state tortures, not only in black sites, such as Bagram or Guantanamo Bay, but in supermax facilities, such as the one in Florence, Colorado, where inmates suffer psychological breakdowns from prolonged solitary confinement. Prisoners endure round-the-clock electronic monitoring and 23-hour-a-day lockdowns. They undergo extreme sensory deprivation. They are beaten. They must shower and go to the bathroom on camera. They can write only one letter a week to one relative and cannot use more than three pieces of paper. They often have no access to fresh air and take their 1 hour of daily recreation in a huge cage that resembles a treadmill for hamsters. The state uses special administration measures known as SAMs to strip citizens of their judicial rights. SAMs restrict a citizen's communication with the outside world. They end calls, letters, and visits with anyone except attorneys, and sharply limit contact with family members. Citizens under SAMs are not permitted to see most of the evidence against them because of a legal provision called the Classified Information Procedures Act, or SIPA. SIPA, instituted under the Reagan administration, allows evidence in a trial to be classified. And those who are tried and convicted, like Joseph K. in Franz Kafka's The Trial, can be found guilty without ever seeing the evidence brought against them. And under SAMs, it is against the law for those who have contact with someone held under SAMs, including attorneys, to speak about the physical and psychological conditions being inflicted on the prisoner. When prisoners in our society are released, they have lost the right to vote and receive public assistance. They are burdened with fines that, if unpaid, will put them back behind bars. They are subject to arbitrary searches and arrests. They spend the rest of their lives marginalized as members of a vast criminal caste system. And that is why 76% of those released from state penitentiaries return to prison within 5 years. Our system of mass incarceration, however, is not, as critics charge, broken. It works exactly the way it is designed to work. The bodies of poor people of color do not generate money for corporations on the streets of our deindustrialized cities, but they generate $40,000 or $50,000 a year if we lock them in cages, and that is why they are there. The executive branch of government is empowered to assassinate U.S. citizens. It can call the army into the streets to quell civil unrest under Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, overturning the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act, which prohibited the military from acting as a domestic police force. The executive branch can order the military to seize U.S. citizens deemed to be terrorists or associated with terrorists, and this is called extraordinary rendition. Those seized can be denied due process and habeas corpus and held indefinitely in military facilities. Constitutionally protected statements, beliefs, and associations are now criminalized. The state can detain and prosecute people not for what they have done, or even for what they are planning to do, but for holding religious or political beliefs that the state deems seditious. The first of those targeted have been observant Muslims, but they will not be the last. The outward forms of democratic participation, voting, competing political parties, judicial oversight, and legislation are meaningless theater. No one who lives under constant surveillance, who is subject to detention anywhere at any time, who has lost their legal rights, who cannot protect themselves from corporate exploitation, whose conversations, messages, meetings, proclivities, and habits are recorded, stored, and analyzed, can be described as free. The relationship between the state and the citizen who is watched constantly is one of master and slave, and the shackles will not be removed if Trump disappears. The dismantling of democratic institutions, places where the citizen has agency and a voice, is far graver than the ascendancy to the White House of Trump. The coup destroyed the two-party system. It destroyed labor unions. It destroyed public education. It destroyed the judiciary. It destroyed the press. It destroyed academia. It destroyed consumer and environmental protection. It destroyed our industrial base. It destroyed communities and cities. And it destroyed the lives of tens of millions of Americans, no longer able to find work that provides a living wage, cursed to live in chronic poverty, or locked in cages. Perhaps even more ominously, this coup destroyed the credibility of liberal democracy itself. Self-identified liberals such as the Clintons and Barack Obama mouthed the words of liberal democratic values while making war on these values in the service of corporate power. And this rendered these values meaningless. The revolt we see rippling across the country is a revolt not only against a corporate system that has betrayed workers, but also for many, the tenets that define a traditional democracy. And this is very dangerous. It will allow the radical right, with or without Trump, to cement into place and Americanized fascism. The acceleration of deindustrialization by the 1970s created a crisis that forced the ruling elites to adopt a new ideology, as Sturt Hall explains in his book, Policing the Crisis. This ideology, trumpeted by a compliant media, shifted its focus from the common good to race, crime, and law and order. It told those undergoing profound economic and political change that their suffering stemmed not from corporate greed, but from a threat to national integrity. The old consensus that buttressed the programs of the New Deal and the welfare state was discredited as enabling criminal black youth, welfare queens, and social parasites. These parasites were to blame. And this opened the door to an authoritarian populism begun by Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, which supposedly championed family values, traditional morality, individual autonomy, law and order, the Christian faith, and the return of a mythical past.
Now, I don't usually break up speeches like this, but I thought, well, that actually does fit so well with some points made by Richard Wolff about what went on since the mid-1970s, because capitalism required it to go on. So, before we continue with the remainder of Chris Hedges' speech, This is a speech by Richard Wolff at the Left Forum in 2018.
I want to start by reminding you of a section of the Communist Manifesto that Karl Marx wrote 150 or whatever it is now, 170 years ago. He was stung at that time when he was writing that by an attack made against radicals, leftists, socialists. Not that many people used that language quite then. In fact, he was a bit daring even by using the word communist in the name of the manifesto he wrote. But people were attacking leftists those days on the grounds that, quote unquote, they are against the family. That if communists were in power, they would destroy the family. They are anti-family. I tell you that for two reasons. One, the sad reality that you also live in a society right now where the right wing likes to attack people like us as lacking family values. So something hasn't changed. And Marx's answer hasn't changed either. Marx's answer was, you accuse us of destroying the family? You must be kidding. We are not in the position to destroy their family. You've already done that. And what he meant was, you have put the proletarians of the world into situations where any family-type relationship is unobtainable and unsustainable. You're the perpetrator of the destruction of the family, not us. Keep in mind, though, that he had to face the fact that the people who had destroyed the family by creating economic conditions that made family unsurvivable had somehow blamed somebody else, namely them. And I'm now going to tell you a story of how pretty much the same thing is being done here and has been for 30 years, maybe 40, maybe 50. Okay. It starts here in the 1970s. This is a stylized story, so I'm not going to get all the details, but the basic story. For most of the years from 45 to 75, those 30 years after World War II, the United States economy was in a very peculiar situation. All the other capitalist countries of the world were destroyed. They couldn't compete. They couldn't produce anything. They had had a horrific war on their country, whereas we had none, excepting Pearl Harbor, and that didn't do the damage that was suffered in France or Germany or Russia or any of the other countries that we would compete with. And so it was possible for the United States to produce for everybody, and therefore to pay rising wages because they could charge whatever they needed to recoup the rising wage. For those of you who don't know, the Marshall Plan that helped Europe had a little detail in it. We're going to give you all this money, you in Europe and elsewhere, on condition that you buy American products at whatever price the American producer chose to charge. We therefore ripped the Europeans off, made a huge amount of money, and were able to tell our workers, you don't need to be left-wingers or radicals, because in the 30s they were, because we'll raise your wages without class struggle, because we don't have to pay. We have those Europeans flat on their back. The important thing is that for those 30 years, American workers could be given what they had, not quite to the same degree, but enjoyed even earlier, what came to be called a family wage. Basically enough money to allow the woman, the wife, the mother, to stay at home, raise the children. Of course, poorer people couldn't have that luxury. Non-white people particularly could not have that luxury. But a lot of white people did. And then this lovely 30-year period, 1945 to 75, came to an end. The Europeans had the bad taste to rebuild their economies. The Japanese, equally, the bad taste to rebuild their economies. And, of course, being capitalist economies, they knew who they had to beat. They had to beat the United States. They had to produce what the United States produced, either better quality or a cheaper price, or best of all, both. Otherwise, they'd have no chance. In a world dominated by the United States, militarily, politically, culturally, if you're going to succeed as a capitalist in Japan or Germany or anywhere else, you better outdo the Americans. So they set themselves to do that, and by and large, they did. So by the 1970s, Americans were trading in their Fords and Chevys and buying VWs and eventually Hondas, and you know the rest. The United States could no longer get away with the game for those first 30 years. It had to change the game. And the 1970s was the time when the game got changed. And the basic change of the game was no more wage increases. We're going to compete with these foreigners, and we're going to do it by taking it out on you, the American working class. That's always the first choice. But not just that. We're going to do a multi-pronged effort. We're going to start using technology in a way we hadn't before, replacing expensive workers, which is a double benefit because not only do you save money on the worker you replace with a machine, but you make that worker compete with the remaining workers driving down the wages. It's a nice twofer. And so they did that. And finally, when neither of those strategies were available, they went two more steps. One, they moved the jobs out of the country to where the wages were cheap, and they moved the cheap workers from whatever country they were in here to have them available here and to press down the wages, all of which worked out real well. In short, the problems of capitalist enterprises starting in the 1970s were solved by ripping off two other institutions in our society. The first one was the state. I won't go through it all with you, but you do know 1970s is when we begin to have what came to be called the tax revolt of the American people. The reality was slashing the government. Mr. Reagan is the moment when you go from government as the solution to the problems of a depressed economy that comes out of the depression into government is the problem, not the solution. And the solution is to get rid of the government, cut the taxes, cut government spending, the mantra of the Republican Party and much of the Democratic Party ever since. So the capitalists are going to solve their problem by attacking the state so they don't have to pay taxes. The culmination of that, the tax cut of last December, 2017, which caps 40 years of reducing the burden on corporations by reducing it some more. Attack the government. Immobilize the government. But I said there were two institutions. What was the other institution that the capitalists attacked in order to solve their problems? And the answer is the family. When the wages go down because you have technological change, export of job, bringing in immigrants, when you do that, it's no longer possible, particularly for the white male, keep that in your head, to have a salary that can sustain the white female at home, being the homemaker, the mother, the emotional center of the family, etc., etc. She can't do that because you can't sustain your standard of living. The thing you've promised to one another when you got married, the thing you've promised to your children, you can't afford it anymore. For those of you who don't know, the real wage that had been rising for 100 years in this country before the 1970s stopped rising. It hasn't risen since. The real wage didn't go up anymore. Meanwhile, the name of what an American dream to a family meant kept rising. No way out. So what did American families do when they couldn't do this anymore? When the capitalist system said, we're going to save the profits of business and we're going to stick it to the government and we're going to stick it to the family. Families did two things in response to this attack. They didn't want to give up the American dream. They didn't want to. They had been told that that was their birthright. That was the American experience. That was the uniqueness, the exceptionalism of America, all of that. So American families tried to hold on in this impossible situation. So they did two things. Number one, they did more hours of work. More people in the family took jobs, and if they had a job, they did a second job or more hours. And the second thing they did, because it wasn't enough to take more hours, well, if your wages are going nowhere but you have to spend more money, then that woman has to go out to work. No more homemaker, mother, out. If you want to call that liberation, fine. That's like when you don't eat meat anymore and you switch from hamburger to hamburger helper and you tell yourself it's because of your diet. Doesn't mean it isn't true, but it means you're using a cover for something whose other reality you don't quite want to see. So Americans not only did more work to hold on to the American dream, but they sent the wife out. And when that wasn't enough, and it wasn't, basically because when the wife goes out to work, the family has new expenses it didn't have before. She has to have a whole other set of clothes for the job. And they maybe have to get another car in a country whose public transportation is as crappy as ours is, etc., etc. So the families did that last thing. They borrowed money like no working class has ever borrowed money before. We became pioneers, only not this time in a covered wagon going across the prairie. We became pioneers in a level of socialized consumer debt that is still the model for the world. Homeowner debt, car debt, credit card debt, and in the last 20 years, an added one, student debt. Fantastic. Load the population up. The only way you can now get that American dream is if you're working your ass off all the time and you're anxiety-ridden because of debts you know you can't pay. Of course you destroy the family. Are you kidding? Either one of those would have been enough. The combination, a knockout blow. Nobody's home enough. Everybody's catching a bit of yogurt on the way home as a substitute for a family dinner, right? Should be familiar to all of you. The family as an institution is destroyed over the last 40 years. Think about the difference between television programs, for those of you who've had a chance to look at them, that are 40 years old. The lovely husband going out to work with the briefcase and the tie, and the lovely wife at home who's waiting for his return as she grooms Spot the dog and plays with Dick and Jane on the lawn waiting for Daddy to come home. Isn't this charming? And the little foibles as they lead their wonderfully wonder-bred lives. Now fast forward 30 years, and what do you get? The dysfunctional family. The wife who makes jokes about the sexual inadequacy of the husband who repays her in kind. The children who roll their eyes, clearly understanding that their families, their parents, couldn't possibly have done what brought them into the world by the very nature of their awkward incompatibility. It's a cultural transformation, but it mirrors the economic reality. The family is done. Many of you are the products of these families. I don't want to upset you, but you already know that. As Harriet Fraud will tell you, the signs of it in people's decisions about whether or not to get married, whether or not to have children, it's already there. You already know it. You already know it. So let me conclude by telling you what the consequences are of the destruction of the family because it was needed by a capitalist system at a certain time to solve its problems that way. First, there was a genius appropriation of this process by the Republican Party in the United States, and the complete missing of what's going on by the Democratic Party, which, if you follow politics, shouldn't surprise you. This is a repetition over and over again, right up to the present. Here's what the Republican Party understood. Having helped the capitalists more than the Democrats to carry through all of these steps, cutting the taxes of the government, making the government smaller, weakening the unions, all opening the globe for American expansion, all the things Republicans do more than Democrats, and having thereby smashed the family, the Republican Party realized that the way to save this situation for themselves was to position themselves as the champion of family values. That's genius. You destroy an institution, throw people into the horror of living out the destruction of what they had been led to expect, and then you say, vote for us, we'll bring it all back. The Democrats, moving with real skill into the level of complete stupidity, didn't see any of it. Didn't understand what's this family values, hypocritical, missed the whole thing. They thereby got the mass of people suffering what it means to have no family in a very rapacious capitalist universe where you have to work longer hours and you're tired, and the family might have been that haven in a heartless world that Marx once referred to it as. It couldn't function that way. But people were distraught. And the Republicans came along and said, yes, the family is under attack, and it's what? They're not going to say it's the capitalists, that's them. So who is it? It's homosexuals. It's homosexuals. And anybody else they could think of other than the capitalist system. Anybody. Democrats, in fact, could be pointed out. So you turn the destruction of the family not into not only an asset for Republicans, but a loss for the Democrats. Without that move, the Republicans would not have been able to have power in the last 35 years of American society. No Trump, no Bush, none of it. That or Reagan. This is a linchpin. That's why this is so important to understand. Of American politics. Last point. There's a Achilles heel of all of this for the Republicans, and I don't want to leave you without making that clear. This embrace of family values has now been split inside the Republican conservative world. It's been split because a subpart of that world wants this to be the celebration not of all family values, but of white people's family values. And by white people's family values, they actually mean white male people's family values. That is, they want the party to become the party of reconstructing the time when, whether it's real or fantasy is really not the point here, but to reconstruct an America in which white men have their white wife back with Dick, Jane, and Spot so that they can come home from their insecure 80-hour-a-week job to enjoy what's left of the lawn in our ecologically mangled culture. But it's a serious image. They're going to bring it back. They have to argue that they're going to bring it back. And therein lies something which, if we're lucky, will be a fatal flaw, because they can't. They're not bringing it back, not because they wouldn't like to in some fantastic way, but because they cannot. And it is extremely dangerous to sell yourself to the mass of the American people as the deliverer of a package that never comes. You know how you feel about UPS and Amazon when it never comes after you've paid. Why can't it come? Because nothing is stopping the capitalists from their appointed rounds. They're moving jobs out of the country. They're bringing cheap labor in. All the noise about immigrants is undone as fast as it's passed. It's all political theater. If you pay attention, immigrants are being brought in because the farms can't run without them, because the hospitals need them for the work that's underpaid, all of the other things that Americans can't do. Or if you have Americans doing, which is much more important, they will be so angry and bitter that it's more dangerous for capitalism than to bring the damn immigrants back and live with the tensions that that involves. You can't bring it back. You can't deliver. The jobs aren't there, the incomes aren't there, and the capitalists are not playing in this game, which means the Republicans are working against the clock. They're promising they cannot deliver. Sooner or later, that blows up. And the only real question is whether the left, inside or outside the Democratic Party, assuming that inside they're still there, the question is whether we have the analytic and the organization to expose this story and to offer a whole new way of organizing society that can actually make emotional, personal, intimate, sexual relations among people a priority that the society respects and supports, rather than something thrown away when the difficulties of profitability lead corporations to do all that and let the chips fall where they may. Capitalism destroyed the family. And if that's a problem for you, which it is, then your anger and your hostility ought to go to where the problem starts. And it's not homosexuals. Thank you.
Now, we continue with the second half of Chris Hedges' speech.
It turns out, 45 years later, that those who truly hate us for our freedoms are not the array of dehumanized enemies cooked up by the war machine, the Vietnamese, Cambodians, Afghans, Iraqis, Iranians, even the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, or ISIS. They are the financiers, bankers, politicians, public intellectuals, and pundits, lawyers, journalists, and business people, cultivated in the elite universities and business schools, who sold us the utopian dream of neoliberalism. We are entering the twilight phase of capitalism. Capitalists, unable to generate profits by expanding markets, has, as Karl Marx predicted, begun to cannibalize the state like ravenous parasites. Wealth is no longer created by producing or manufacturing. It is created by manipulating the prices of stocks and commodities and imposing a crippling debt peonage on the public. This casino capitalism is designed to prey on the desperate, young men and women burdened by student loans, underpaid workers burdened by credit card debt and mortgages, towns and cities forced to borrow to maintain municipal services. This seminal moment in human history marks the end of a long, tragic tale of plunder and murder by the white race. It is inevitable that for the final act, we vomited up Trump. Europeans and Americans have spent five centuries conquering, plundering, exploiting, and polluting the earth in the name of civilization and human progress. They used their technological superiority to create the most efficient killing machines on the planet, directed against anyone or anything, especially indigenous cultures, which stood in their way. They stole and hoarded the planet's wealth and resources. They believe this orgy of blood and gold will never end. They do not understand that the dark ethic of ceaseless capitalism and imperialist expansion is over, and that it is dooming the exploiters as well as the exploited. But even as we stand on the cusp of extinction, we lack the ability to free ourselves from the myth of human progress. Walter Benjamin wrote in 1940, amid the rise of European fascism and looming world war, this. A Klee painting named Angelus Novus shows an angel looking as though he is about to move away from something he is fixedly contemplating. His eyes are staring. His mouth is open. His wings are spread. This is how one pictures the angel of history. His face is turned towards the past. Where we perceive a chain of events, he sees one single catastrophe, which keeps piling wreckage upon wreckage and hurls it in front of his feet. The angel would like to stay, awaken the dead, and make whole what has been smashed. But a storm is blowing from paradise. It has got caught in his wings with such violence that the angel can no longer close them. The storm irresistibly propels him into the future to which his back is turned, while the pile of debris before him grows skyward. This storm is what we call progress. The more the warning signs are palpable, rising temperatures, global financial meltdowns, mass migrations, endless wars, poisoned ecosystems, rampant corruption among the ruling elites. The more we turn to those who insist that what worked in the past will work in the future, that progress is inevitable. Factual evidence, since it is an impediment to what we desire, is banished. The taxes of corporations and the rich, who have turned most of our cities into wastelands, are cut. Regulations and laws are rescinded. To bring back the supposed golden era of the 1950s for white American workers. Public lands are opened up to the oil and gas industry, even as rising carbon emissions doom our species. Declining crop yields stemming from heat waves and droughts are ignored. War becomes the principal business of the kleptocratic state. Magical thinking is not limited to the beliefs and practices of pre-modern cultures. It defines the ideology of capitalism. Quotas and projected sales can always be met. Profits can always be raised. Growth is inevitable. The impossible is always possible. Human societies, if they bow before the dictates of the marketplace, will be ushered into a capitalist paradise. It is only a question of having the right attitude and the right technique. When capitalism thrives, we are assured we thrive. The merging of the self with the capitalist collective has robbed us of our agency, creativity, capacity for self-reflection, and moral autonomy. We define our worth not by our independence or our character, but by the material standards set by capitalism: wealth, brands, status, career advancement. We have been molded into a compliant and repressed collective. This conformity is characteristic of totalitarian and authoritarian states. It is expressed in the Disneyfication of America, the land of eternally happy thoughts and positive attitudes. And when magical thinking does not work, we are told and often accept that we are the problem. We must have more faith. We must envision what we want. We must try harder. The system is never to blame. We failed it. It does not fail us. And all our systems of information, from self-help gurus to Hollywood, to charlatans such as Trump, sell us this snake oil. What does resistance look like now? It will not come by investing hope in the Democratic Party, which did not lose the elections because of Comey or the Russians, but because it betrayed working men and women on behalf of corporate power and used its machinery to deny the one candidate, Bernie Sanders, who could have defeated Trump, from getting the nomination. The proposed cuts, $9.2 billion from the Department of Education, $616 billion from Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program over 10 years, $200 billion from the food stamp program, a lifeline for 44 million people, $72 billion for people with disabilities, $39 billion for subsidized student loans, and $859 million for public service loan forgiveness, along with a $500 billion increase to the Pentagon's budget over the next decade. Accelerates the austerity programs and militarism that has been embraced by the Democratic Party. As Diane Ravitch pointed out, for example, the Democrats bear as much responsibility for Betsy DeVos as the Republicans. DeVos's proposed voucher system, allowing parents to use public funding for private and religious schools, is modeled on a school choice program introduced by then-Governor Bill Clinton. This voucher system was promoted by Obama and Arne Duncan. Obama closed countless public schools. He doubled the number of students attending charter schools. And it was Bill Clinton and the Democratic Party who gave us NAFTA, the destruction of welfare, the deregulation of the FCC, the explosion of our prison population, and the abolishment of Glass-Steagall that precipitated the global financial meltdown. Yes! Resistance will entail a personal commitment to refuse to cooperate in large and small ways with the machinery of corporate power, especially the fossil fuel industry. After all, the only safe figure for carbon emissions is zero. This will require us, as Ralph Nader has long said, to show up. We have to, as Max Weber advised, make politics a vocation. And resistance will begin locally as we transform our neighborhoods and our communities. In the conflicts I covered as a reporter in Latin America, Africa, the Middle East, and the Balkans, I encountered singular individuals of varying creeds, religions, races, and nationalities who majestically rose up to defy the oppressor on behalf of the oppressed. Some of them are dead. Some of them are forgotten. Most of them are unknown. These individuals, despite their vast cultural differences, had common traits: a profound commitment to the truth, incorruptibility, courage, a distrust of power, a hatred of violence, and a deep empathy that was extended to people who were different from them, even to people defined by the dominant culture as the enemy. They are the most remarkable men and women I met in my 20 years as a foreign correspondent. And to this day, I set my life by the standards they set. You have heard of some, such as Václav Havel, whom I and other foreign reporters met most evenings during the Velvet Revolution in Prague in 1989 at the Magic Lantern Theater. Others, no less great, you may not know, such as the Jesuit priest Ignacio Ellacuría, who was assassinated in El Salvador in 1989. And then, there are those ordinary people, although, as the writer V.S. Pritchett said, no people are ordinary, who risk their lives in wartime to shelter and protect those of an opposing religion or ethnicity who were being persecuted and hunted. And to some of these ordinary people, I owe my life. To resist radical evil is to endure a life that, by the standards of the wider society, is a failure. It is to defy injustice at the cost of your career, your reputation, your financial solvency, and at times your life. It is to be a lifelong heretic. And perhaps this is the most important point. It is to accept that the dominant culture, and perhaps, and maybe even especially the liberal elites, will push you to the margins and attempt to discredit not only what you do, but your character. When I returned to the newsroom at the New York Times in 2003, after denouncing the invasion of Iraq and being publicly reprimanded for my stance against the war, reporters and editors I had known and worked with for 15 years lowered their heads or turned away when I was nearby. Ruling institutions, the state, the press, the church, the courts, academia, mouth the language of morality, but they serve the structures of power, no matter how venal, which provide them with money, status, and authority. In times of national distress, one has only to look at Nazi Germany. All these institutions, including the academy, are complicit through their silence or their active collaboration with radical evil. And our institutions are no different. The lonely individuals who defy tyrannical power within these institutions, as we saw with the thousands of academics who were fired from their jobs and blacklisted during the McCarthy era, are usually purged and turned into pariahs. All institutions, including the church, Paul Tillich once wrote, are inherently demonic. And a life dedicated to resistance has to accept that a relationship with any institution is usually temporary, because sooner or later that institution is going to demand acts of silence or obedience your conscience will not allow you to make. To be a rebel is to reject the capitalist mantra that I come first. The theologian James Cone, in his book, The Cross and the Lynching Tree, writes that for oppressed blacks, the cross was a paradoxical religious symbol because it inverts the world's value system. With the news that hope comes by way of defeat, that suffering and death do not have the last word, that the last shall be first and the first last. Cone continues that God could make a way out of no way, and Jesus' cross was truly absurd to the intellect, yet profoundly real in the souls of black folk. Enslaved blacks who first heard the gospel message seized on the power of the cross. Christ crucified manifested God's loving and liberating presence in the contradictions of black life. That transcendent presence in the lives of black Christians that empowered them to believe that ultimately, in God's eschatological future, they would not be defeated, by the troubles of this world, no matter how great and painful their suffering. Believing this paradox, this absurd claim of faith, was only possible in humility and repentance. There was no place for the proud and the mighty, for people who think that God called them to rule over others. The cross was God's critique of power, white power, with powerless love, snatching victory out of defeat. Reinhold Niebuhr labeled this capacity to defy the forces of repression a sublime madness in the soul. Niebuhr wrote that nothing but madness will do battle with malignant power and spiritual wickedness in high places. This sublime madness, as Niebuhr understood, is dangerous, but it is vital. Without it, truth is obscured. And Niebuhr also knew that traditional liberalism was a useless force in moments of extremity. Liberalism, Niebuhr said, lacks the spirit of enthusiasm, not to say fanaticism, which is so necessary to move the world out of its beaten tracks. It is too intellectual and too little emotional to be an efficient force in history. The prophets in the Hebrew Bible had this sublime madness. The words of the prophets, as Abraham Heschel wrote, were a scream in the night. While the world is at ease and asleep, the prophet feels the blast from heaven. The prophet, because he or she saw and faced an unpleasant reality, was, as Heschel wrote, compelled to proclaim the very opposite of what his or her heart expected. This sublime madness is the essential quality for a life of resistance. It is the acceptance that although empirically all that we struggle to achieve during our lifetime may be worse, our struggle validates itself. Daniel Berrigan once told me that faith is the belief that the good draws to it the good. The Buddhists call this karma. But he said for us, we did not know where it goes. We trust that it goes somewhere. We do not know where. But we are called to do the good, or at least the good insofar as we can determine it, and then let it go. As Hannah Arendt wrote in The Origins of Totalitarianism, the only morally reliable people are not those who say, this is wrong, or this should not be done, but those who say, I can't. They know that, as Immanuel Kant wrote, if justice perishes, human life on earth has lost its meaning. And this means that, like Socrates, we must come to a place where it is better to suffer wrong than to do wrong. We must at once see and act. And given what it means to see, this will require the surmounting of despair, not by reason, but by faith. I saw in the conflicts I covered the power of this faith, which lies outside of any religious or philosophical creed. This faith is what Havel called in his essay, The Power of the Powerless, living in truth. Living in truth exposes the corruption, lies, and deceit of the state. It is a refusal to be part of the charade, and it has a cost. You do not become a dissident just because you decide one day to take up this most unusual career, Havel wrote. You are thrown into it by your personal sense of responsibility, combined with a complex set of external circumstances. You are cast out of the existing structures and placed in a position of conflict with them. It begins as an attempt to do your work well and ends with being branded an enemy of society. The dissident does not operate in the realm of genuine power at all. He or she is not seeking power. He or she has no desire for office and does not gather votes. He or she does not attempt to charm the public. He or she offers nothing and promises nothing. He or she can offer, if anything, only their own skin. And they offer it solely because they have no other way of affirming the truth they stand for. Their actions simply articulate their dignity as a citizen, regardless of the cost. The long, long road of sacrifice and defiance that led to the collapse of the communist regime stretched back decades. Those who made change possible were those who had discarded all notions of the practical. They did not try to reform the Communist Party. They did not attempt to work within the system. They did not even know what, if anything, their tiny protests, ignored by the state-controlled media, would accomplish. But through it all, they held fast to moral imperatives. They did so because these values were right and just. They expected no reward for their virtue. Indeed, they got none. They were marginalized and persecuted. And yet, these rebels, poets, playwrights, actors, singers, and writers ultimately triumphed over state and military power. They drew the good to the good. They triumphed because, however cowed and broken, the people around them appeared. Their message did not go unheard. It did not go unseen. The steady drumbeat of rebellion exposes the dead hand of authority and the rot of the state. I stood with hundreds of thousands of Czechs in 1989 on a cold winter night in Prague's Venceslas Square. As the singer Marta Kubišová approached the balcony of the Milantrik building, Kubišová had been banished from the airwaves in 1968 after the Soviet invasion for her anthem of defiance, A Prayer for Marta. Her entire catalog, including more than 200 singles, had been confiscated and destroyed. She had disappeared from public view. Her voice that night suddenly flooded the square. Pressing around me were throngs of students, most of whom had not been born when she vanished from public view. They began to sing the words of the anthem. There were tears running down their faces. It was then that I understood the power of resistance. It was then that I knew that no act of rebellion, however futile it appears in the moment, is wasted. And it was then that I knew that the communist regime was finished. The walls of Prague were covered that winter with posters of Jan Palach. Palach, a university student, set himself on fire in Venceslas Square on January 16th, 1969, in the middle of the day, to protest the crushing of the country's democracy movement. He died of his burns 3 days later. The state swiftly attempted to erase his act from national memory. There was no mention of it on the state media. A funeral march by university students was broken up by the police. Palach's gravesite, which became a shrine, saw the communist authorities exhume his body, cremate his remains, and ship them to his mother with the provision that his ashes could not be placed in a cemetery. But it did not work. His sacrifice spurred the students in the winter of 1989 to act Prague's Red Army Square. Shortly after I left for Bucharest to cover the uprising in Romania, was renamed Pollock Square, and 10,000 people were at the dedication. We may feel powerless, but we are not. We have a power that terrifies the corporate state. Any act of rebellion, no matter how few people show up or how heavily it is censored, chips away at corporate power. Any act of rebellion keeps alive the embers for larger movements to follow. It passes on another narrative. And it will, as the state consumes itself, attract wider and wider numbers. Perhaps this will not happen in our lifetimes, but if we persist, we keep this possibility alive, and if we do not, it will die. Dr. Rio and Albert Camus' novel, The Plague, is not driven to act by ideology. He is driven by empathy, the duty to minister to the suffering of others, no matter the cost. To act on this empathy, the empathy for human beings locked in cages, the empathy for undocumented mothers and fathers being torn from their children on the streets of our cities, the empathy for Muslims who are demonized and banned from our shores, fleeing the wars and terror we created, the empathy for poor people of color gunned down by police in our streets, the empathy for girls and women trafficked into prostitution, the empathy for our great and glorious earth, which gives us life and which is being destroyed, is not only viewed by despots as political, but seditious. A life of faith, and we are all called to faith, is a life of confrontation. As Flannery O'Connor writes of St. Cyril of Jerusalem and instructing catechumens, the dragon sits by the side of the road, watching those who pass. Beware, lest he devour you. We go to the Father of souls, but it is necessary to pass by the dragon. No matter what form the dragon may take, it is of this mysterious passage past him or into his jaws that stories of any depth will always be concerned to tell. And this being the case, it requires considerable courage at any time in any country not to turn away from the storyteller. Accept sorrow, for who cannot be profoundly sorrowful at the state of our nation, the world, what we are doing to our planet? But know that in resistance, there is a balm that leads to wisdom, and if not joy, a strange, transcendent happiness. Know that as long as we resist, we keep hope alive. My faith has been tempered in hell, wrote Vasily Grossman in Life and Fate. My faith has emerged from the flames of the crematoria, from the concrete of the gas chamber. I have seen that it is not man who is impotent in the struggle against evil, but the power of evil that is impotent in the struggle against man. The powerlessness of kindness, of senseless kindness, is the secret of its immortality. It can never be conquered. The more stupid, the more senseless, the more helpless it may seem, the vaster it is. Evil is impotent before it. The prophets, religious leaders, reformers, social and political leaders are impotent before it. This dumb, blind love is man's meaning. Human history is not the battle of good struggling to overcome evil. It is the battle fought by a great evil, struggling to crush a small kernel of human kindness. But if what is human in human beings has not been destroyed even now, then evil will never conquer. The days ahead will be dark and frightening, but we must fight for the sacred. We must fight for life. We must fight the forces of death. We fight not only for ourselves, but for those who will come after us, our children. Revolt is a political necessity. It is a moral imperative. We must not be complicit. We must live in truth. The moment we defy power in any form, we are victorious. The moment we stand with the oppressed and accept being treated like the oppressed, we are victorious. The moment we hold up a flickering light in the darkness for others to see, we are victorious. The moment we thwart the building of a pipeline or a fracking site, we are victorious. The moment we keep a mother faced with deportation with her children, we are victorious. The moment we mass in the streets to defy police violence, we are victorious. We must turn the tide of fear. We must, by taking the streets, make the ruling elites frightened of us. To sit idle, to refuse to defy these forces, to by our silence be complicit, will atrophy and wither our souls. It will leave us husks of human beings. This is not only a fight for life. It is a fight that gives life. It is the supreme expression of faith. It is the belief that no matter how great is the power of evil, the power of love is greater. I do not, in the end, fight fascists because I will win. I fight fascists because they are fascists. Thank you.
This and all previous episodes of the show are available for download from unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Theme tune, The Unwelcome Guest, is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I've got so much to say on this topic, but don't get me started. I'm just finishing. I'm still working within the 2 hour per show limit. Perhaps I'll make another one next week. And if you'd like to suggest material for the show, you can email me, robin-upton@robinupton.com. Listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
PUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Parenti, The Supremely Political Court.
The court has been very protective of executive power. Neither Congress nor the Constitution granted this power to the executive, but the bench declared that in matters of foreign policy and national security, the president now could do whatever he wanted in the absence of specific legislative prohibition.
In his extraordinary 26-minute history of the Supreme Court, Dr. Michael Parenti warned us in 1995 that this partisan aristocratic institution might one day empower an autocratic president. It seems that time has come, and two Trump appointees, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, can push the scales of justice in favor of his politics. Unless there's a groundswell to question and change the legal rules of the Supreme Court, why is so much power being given to 9 unelected judges with no term limits? Here's my introduction to the program when it premiered in 1995. Michael Parenti was born into a working-class Italian family in East Harlem, New York City. He went on to receive his PhD in political science at Yale in 1962. His academic career was cut short by his dismissal. He was arrested for protesting the U.S. war in Vietnam. Parenti became an independent scholar, lecturer, and author. And he remained an activist as well. In 1995, I produced the 12-part TUC radio series, Democracy, What Went Wrong, using archival and new recordings of Parenti's lectures. He comments on major institutions such as the military, the CIA, media, corporations, universities, police, and the Supreme Court, offering suggestions on how to regain democratic control. Today I chose to rebroadcast Michael Parenti's extraordinary history and analysis of the Supreme Court. Over 20 years ago, Parenti already pointed to the role of the court in concentrating wealth in the top 1%, and the way in which the Supreme Court expanded the power of corporations and laid the groundwork for what later became the Citizens United ruling of 2009. And most dangerously, how the Supreme Court began to give powers to the president in matters of foreign policy and national security that neither Congress nor the Constitution had granted. Parenti said, by judicial fiat, the president could now do whatever he wanted in the absence of specific legislative prohibitions. The example of unchallenged executive power that Parenti quoted 20 years ago in this talk are the undeclared war in Vietnam, the unprovoked U.S. invasion of Grenada, and the U.S. invasion of Panama. Here's Michael Parenti on the Supremely Political Court.
We're told that our Constitution is a flexible one that grows with time. It's an elastic instrument. If it is, much of the stretching has been done by the 9 persons on the Supreme Court, and the directions in which they pull are largely determined by their own ideological predilections. As Chief Justice Hughes pointed out years ago, we are under a constitution, but the constitution is what the judges say it is. That's a direct quote. By its nature, the Supreme Court is something of an aristocratic branch of government. Its members are appointed rather than elected. They enjoy life tenure and are formally accountable to no one once in office, and they have the final word on constitutional matters and a great influence in their power to interpret the scope and intent of laws. As intended by the framers, the court's mandate is to act as a check on the Democratic majority and as a protector of private contract, credit, and property. Generally speaking, in class background and political proclivity, the justices have been more commonly identified throughout the ages with the landed interest rather than with the landless. They've identified with the slave owners rather than the slaves, the industrialists rather than the workers, the exponents of Herbert Spencer rather than of Karl Marx. Over a century ago, Justice Miller, a Lincoln appointee to the court, made note of the judiciary's class biases. Quote, "It is vain to contend with judges who have been at the bar, the advocates, for 40 years of railroad companies and all forms of associated capital. All their training, all their feelings are from the start in favor of those who need no such influence." Unquote. How a Supreme Court justice or any other federal judge decides a case has less to do with objective inquiry than with his or her ideological preference. Both conservative and liberal ideologies, of course, accept the existing economic system as an unchallengeable given. Occasionally, a president will select someone for the court whose behavior goes contrary to his expectations. But generally, presidents have been successful in matching court appointments with their own ideological preferences. President Reagan was second to nobody in this endeavor. He stocked more than half of the 744 federal judgeships with ideologically committed conservatives, mostly in their 30s and 40s, who will be handing down decisions and shaping the law of the land into the second and third decades of the next century. As compared to his predecessor, Jimmy Carter, Reagan appointed very few blacks, Latinos, or women. He also picked many more upper-class persons. 81% of his appointees had incomes of over $200,000. 23% admitted to being millionaires. That's only the ones who admitted it. Reagan's successor, George Bush, appointed an additional 195 federal judges, usually youngish right-wing conservatives, including Clarence Thomas, a 43-year-old undistinguished arch-conservative to replace the great Thurgood Marshall on the Supreme Court. Clarence Thomas will be delivering opinions on into the third decade of the next century, maybe the fourth or fifth, too. When Bill Clinton, a Democrat, became president, he had the opportunity to appoint more than 100 vacancies and introduce some ideological diversity in the courts. As of today, he's filled about 160 of these vacancies, most without a liberal orientation, most of them kind of nondescript in their politics, if they have any politics at all. His two Supreme Court appointees had voted more often with the conservatives than the liberals on economic issues. It is said that the devil himself can quote the Bible for his own purposes. The Constitution is not unlike the Bible in this respect. Over the generations, the Supreme Court justices have really shown a really infernal agility in finding constitutional justifications for the continuations of almost every inequity and iniquity, be it slavery or segregation, child labor or the 16-hour workday, state sedition laws or assaults on the First Amendment. Under state sedition laws, for instance, people went to jail for 20, 30 years because they said things that officials didn't like. In its early days under Chief Justice John Marshall, the court emerged as a guardian of property, declaring that a corporation was to be considered a person entitled to all the rights accorded persons under the Constitution. Much of the debate around the Supreme Court today centers on whether, one, the court should act politically and ideologically by exercising a liberal judicial activism, vigorously supporting individual rights and needs, or B, should it employ a conservative judicial restraint by deferring to the other two branches and cleaving close to the traditional intent of the Constitution. In practice, conservative justices are just as ideologically activist as liberal ones, if not more so. Only during a relatively few periods, most notably in the 1960s, did the High Court become an active supporter of individual rights and economic reform on behalf of the poor. Through most of its history, the court has engaged in a conservative judicial activism in defense of wealthy and propertied interests. when the federal government wanted to establish national banks or give away half the country to private speculators or subsidize industries or set up commissions to fix prices and interest rates for manufacturers and banks or send Marines to secure corporate investments in Central America or imprison people who spoke out against war and capitalism or deport immigrant radicals without a trial or use the United States Army to shoot workers, Indians, and to use them to break strikes. When the government wanted to do that, the Supreme Court inventively found constitutional pegs that made such actions acceptable. When the federal or state governments sought to limit workday hours, set minimum wage or occupational safety standards, ensure the safety of consumer products, guarantee the right of collective bargaining, or in other ways offer protections against the powers of business, then the court historically ruled that ours was a limited form of government that could not tamper with property rights and the free market by depriving owner and worker of substantive due process and freedom of contract, concepts that were elevated to supreme status even though the limitations claimed on their behalf exist nowhere in the Constitution. In fact, those phrases themselves don't. When Congress outlawed child labor, the court's conservative activist majority found it to be an unconstitutional usurpation of the reserve powers of the states under the 10th Amendment. But when the states themselves passed social welfare legislation, the courts found it in violation of the 14th Amendment. Thus, the justices used the 10th Amendment to stop federal reform initiated under the 14th Amendment, and they used the 14th Amendment to stop state reforms initiated under the 10th Amendment. You can't get any more activist than that. The 14th Amendment, adopted in 1868, supposedly to establish full citizenship for blacks and freed slaves, says that no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Once again, the court decided that person in the 14th Amendment included corporations and that the 14th Amendment was intended to protect big business conglomerations. They also decided that it wasn't to apply to black people in the case of segregation. They also decided that it didn't apply to women. For some reason, women were not persons. A test case reached the Supreme Court in 1875. The justices unanimously decided that women were citizens, but citizenship did not necessarily confer the right of suffrage when women tried to get the vote under the 14th Amendment. So the court had made up its mind that privileges and immunities of citizens, due process, and equal protection of the laws applied to persons, such persons as business corporations, but not to women and persons of African descent.
You're listening to rebroadcast of a talk on the Supreme Court by the political analyst, lecturer, and author of 23 books, Michael Parenti, from a 12-part series entitled Democracy, What Went Wrong, produced in 1995.
Well into the New Deal era, the Supreme Court was the activist bastion of laissez-faire capitalism. It struck down all sorts of reform legislation. From 1937 onward, under the pressure from the public and the White House, and with the switch of one conservative justice to the side of the liberals, the Supreme Court finally began to accept the constitutionality of popular New Deal legislation. While traditionally the court has opposed restrictions on capitalist economic power, it has supported restrictions on the civil liberties of persons who agitated against that power. The First Amendment says, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. Yet ever since the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798, Congress and the state legislatures have passed numerous laws to penalize the expression of politically heretical ideas as subversive or seditious. During the First World War, almost 2,000 prosecutions were carried out, mostly against anti-capitalists who expressed opposition to the war, including the U.S. socialist leader Eugene Victor Debs, who was in jail at the time he was running for president of the United States. The High Court's attitude toward the First Amendment was best expressed by Oliver Wendell Holmes in the famous case of Schenck versus U.S. in 1919. Schenck was charged with attempting to cause insubordination among U.S. military forces, obstructing recruitment. Actually, all he did was distribute a leaflet that urged repeal of the draft and condemned the war as a wrong perpetrated by Wall Street. Well, Holmes reasoned that such speech is protected by the First Amendment in ordinary times. But when a nation is at war, statements like Schenck's creates a clear and present danger of bringing about evils that Congress has a right to prevent, Holmes argued. Holmes was using the same old argument paraded by every ruler who has sought to abrogate a people's freedom. Namely, these are not normal times. There is a grave danger within or just outside our gates. National security necessitates a suspension of democratic rights. But you see, the First Amendment was designed to protect the very heretical views that we might find offensive and dangerous. Safely orthodox ideas rarely need constitutional protection. There are those who argue that revolutionaries and other radicals violate the democratic rules of the game and should be denied their freedom. There are several rejoinders that could be made to this point. First, as a point of historical fact, the threat of revolution in the United States has never been as real or harmful or dangerous to our liberties as the measures taken to supposedly protect us from revolutionary ideas. History repeatedly demonstrates the expansive quality of repression. In the name of national security, revolutionary advocacy is suppressed. Then inciting words, then unpopular doctrines, then irresponsible news reports, then any kind of criticism that those in power find intolerable. Americans were never given their freedoms. They had to organize, agitate, and struggle fiercely for whatever rights they've won. As with our bodily health, so with the health of our body politic. We best preserve our faculties and liberties against decay by vigorously exercising them. Second, the suppression is conducted by political elites who, in protecting us from harmful thoughts, are in effect making up our minds for us by depriving us of the opportunity of hearing and debating ideas with revolutionary advocates. An exchange is forbidden because the advocate has been silenced, and which in effect silences us too. Third, it is not true that anti-capitalists are dedicated to the destruction of freedom. Much of the ferment in United States history, instigated by socialists, anarchists, and communists, actually augmented our democratic rights. The working class agitations of the early 19th century widened the areas of dissent and helped extend the franchise to propertyless working people. The organized demonstrations against repressive local ordinances in the early 20th century by revolutionary-minded industrial workers of the world, known as the Wobblies, the Wobbly free speech fights, that fortified the First Amendment against attacks by the guardians of wealth. It made people able to go into small towns and talk and disseminate dissident ideas. The role that communists played in struggling for social reforms, peace, and civil rights strengthened rather than undermined democratic forces. The anti-war protests against the Vietnam War challenged an immoral, illegal military action and tried to broaden the spectrum of critical opinion and information regarding U.S. foreign policy. It also inadvertently led to the enfranchisement of 18-year-olds. Fourth, on this question of whether we should allow freedom for revolutionaries or we should suppress these radicals, progressive critics would argue that instead of worrying about some future menace, we should realize that freedom is in short supply in the present society. The construction of new socioeconomic alternatives would bring an increase in freedom, including freedom from poverty and hunger, freedom to share in the making of decisions that govern one's work and community, freedom to experiment with new forms of production and ownership. Admittedly, some freedoms enjoyed today would be lost in a revolutionary society, such as the freedom to exploit other people and get rich from their labor, the freedom to squander natural resources and treat the environment as a septic tank, the freedom to monopolize information and exercise unaccountable power. Those kinds of freedoms I could live without. In many countries, social revolutionary movements brought a net increase in the freedom of individuals, revolutionaries argue. They did it by advancing the conditions necessary for health and human life, by providing jobs for the unemployed and education for the illiterate, by using economic resources for social development rather than corporate profit, and by overthrowing reactionary semi-feudal regimes, ending foreign exploitation, and involving large sectors of the populace in the task of economic reconstruction. Revolutions may extend a number of real freedoms without destroying those that never existed for the people in these countries. The argument can be debated, but not if it is suppressed. In any case, the real danger to freedom in the United States is from the undemocratic control exercised by those in government, the media, academia, business, and other institutions that would insulate us from unacceptable viewpoints. No idea is as dangerous as the force that would seek to repress it. Packed with Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Bush appointees, the Supreme Court has taken a decidedly rightward turn on a variety of crucial issues over the last two decades. For instance, in decisions involving disputes between workers and owners, the courts almost always have sided with the owners, weakening labor's ability to organize and bargain collectively. The conservative court ruled that workers do not have the right to strike over safety issues if their contract provides a grievance procedure. This decision denied coal miners the right to walk off the job in the face of serious and immediate safety violations that management refused to remedy. The court decided that employers can, in effect, penalize workers for unionizing by closing down operations and denying them jobs. Companies can now unilaterally terminate a labor contract and drastically cut employees' wages by filing for reorganization under the bankruptcy law. Unions have been denied the right to prevent members from quitting the union and crossing picket lines during a strike or when a strike seemed imminent. And one could go on citing other examples. Despite a federal law limiting water subsidies to farms of 160 acres or less and to farmers who live on or near the land, the court held that large commercial farms, including ones owned by Southern Pacific and Standard Oil, were entitled to subsidies. In seeming violation of the Clean Air Act, the court said industries could expand in regions with the dirtiest air, even if it results in worsening pollution. California's Proposition 13 limited tax increases on property bought before 1975 so that persons with newly purchased homes carry tax burdens almost 400% heavier than longtime owners, including big corporate owners. The Supreme Court decided that the existence of a privileged class of property holders did not violate equal protection under the law. Some other areas where conservative judicial activism has been at work. The court has been very protective of executive power. The executive is the home of the CIA, the Pentagon, and other national security agencies that are instrumental in maintaining the domestic and global status quo. It is the branch most closely integrated with the military-industrial complex. Not surprisingly, the conservative-dominated court has repeatedly affirmed the authority of the executive over the legislature and over individual rights. The court ruled that the State Department could deny a passport to a former CIA employee who had written books exposing illegal CIA covert operations. Neither Congress nor the Constitution granted this power to the executive, but the bench declared that in matters of foreign policy and national security, the absence of an empowering law is not to be taken as a sign of congressional disapproval. In other words, by judicial fiat, the president now could do whatever he wanted in the absence of specific legislative prohibition. It's quite different from saying the president can do what he's allowed to do under the laws and constitution. Now he can do anything he wants, it seems. As part of a continuing pattern of deferring to presidential power in military and foreign affairs, the federal courts refused to hear cases challenging the president on such things as the undeclared war in Vietnam, the unprovoked U.S. invasion of Grenada, the imposition of internationally illegal embargoes on Nicaragua, the U.S. invasion of Panama, and the deportation of Haitians, Guatemalan, and Salvadoran refugees. The courts decided that states could not prohibit corporations from independently spending unlimited amounts of their funds to influence the outcome of public referenda. The attempt by states to put a cap on corporate spending in elections and initiatives and referenda is overruled by the court. And any limitations on other elections, because campaign expenditures are, in the words of the court, a part of speech. And the Constitution guarantees freedom of speech to business firms and very rich individuals. Thus, the poor candidate and the rich candidate can both freely compete. Both have freedom of speech, one in a whisper and the other in a roar. Like the courts of earlier times, the activist court has played federal power against state power and vice versa to defend corporate class interests. Thus, it limited the federal government's ability to protect work conditions of employees, claiming an infringement of states' rights under the 10th Amendment. Then it restricted the ability of states to limit businesses' spending power in referenda, claiming federal prerogatives under the First Amendment. In such cases, one hears little complaint from conservatives about the court's activist usurpation of policymaking powers. A consistent double standard prevails. Judicial activism that strengthens authoritarian statism and big corporate business interests is acceptable. Judicial activism that supports democratic working class rights and socioeconomic equality invites attack. One way to trim judicial adventurism is to end life tenure for federal judges, including the justices who sit on the Supreme Court. It would take a constitutional amendment, but it would be worth it. Today, only three states provide life tenure for state judges. The other 47 set terms limits, ranging from 4 to 12 years. Life tenure was supposed to shield the federal judge from outside influences and place the federal courts above partisan politics. Experience shows that judges are as political and ideological as anyone else. Their independence leaves them unchecked by anything but their own sense of propriety. A 7-year or 10-year term limit would still give the jurist significant independence, but would not allow him or her to remain unaccountable for life. Judges who exhibit a hostile view toward constitutional rights could be replaced. No ideological partisan group could pack the courts for decades ahead. There would be more turnover and a greater possibility for more responsiveness to popular needs. And that's the way it should be. The people are not here to serve the courts. The courts should be serving the people.
That was Michael Parenti on the Supremely Political Court. Part of the series, Democracy, What Went Wrong? How the CIA, media, corporations, universities, police, and the Supreme Court are threatening democracy, and what might be done to meet the challenge. The original series was produced by TUC Radio in 1995. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelaiden. Thank you for listening.
And we're back here in Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM, broadcasting to Hamilton at 93.3 on the FM dial, and also the rest of the world, wherever you are, wherever there's internet, at cfmu.ca. That's our new revamped site with blogs, photos, videos, and everything. So check it out, and you can find us at Unusual Sources. Before we start our interview today, there is some exciting news. Here in Hamilton, there is going to be the second film showing for the Hamilton Palestine Film Festival. That is going to be happening on Tuesday, November 6th at McMaster. The film is called Flying Paper, and it's going to be at 6 o'clock p.m., and tickets are $5 in advance. You'll be able to find more information at the Jewish Liberation Theology Institute at jelitin.ca, or check Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War website in a few days. But I'm telling you this because we're doing a giveaway, and the first two people that contact us at unusualsources@gmail.com will get a ticket for this film. It's normally $5 in advance or $8 at the door, but you can get the ticket for free. The first two people to contact us at unusualsources@gmail.com. So do that. It's going to be November 6th. Anyway, you'll hear more about that later. We're very excited right now because there's two things going on. There is the Independent Jewish Voices 10th Anniversary Conference happening in Toronto. And also we have joining us today two people who are involved in Independent Jewish Voices, making this all happen, Corey Balsam and Jean-Vive Nevin, and they are with us today. So both of you, thanks so much for being on the program with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Pleasure.
Absolutely. As I was saying just before the interview, it's a day of firsts for us here at the studio. I've never done a telephone call on a conference call to two other guests, but your role in the organization is so dynamic, and you're getting a lot of attention. It was great to accommodate both of you on the program. People really are curious, and they want to follow what's going on. As I say, there's been a lot of dynamism these days in Independent Jewish Voices, a lot of energy from new people joining the organization, and that applies to you as well. So I'm wondering if both of you can tell us, how did you come to be involved in Independent Jewish Voices?
I can start first because it goes back farther, I suppose. So I am a founding member. So I was there at the 2008 conference in Toronto, which brought together at the beginning something like 20 small Jewish, you know, anti-occupation Palestine solidarity groups to form this one organization. And I mean, I had just pretty much crossed the divide. I grew up very much in kind of the Jewish mainstream community, you know, went to Hebrew school and all that. And I decided for other reasons to study, you know, to take a human rights program at Carleton University, and had managed to kind of ignore it for a while. But it just came to a point where I couldn't stay silent. Basically, I had gone on a trip to Israel and seen for myself a little bit of what was going on, but had realized quite quickly that there was a lot that I wasn't shown or wasn't supposed to see. So that's how I got involved about 10 years ago, and since have spent quite a lot of time in Palestine. I lived in the West Bank for almost 4 years, working on different projects, working at a university there with Oxfam, and I'm now back and working full time as the national coordinator for IJV Canada.
Yeah, it sounds like you bring a lot to the table. The time you've spent abroad, learning and personally experiencing that issue, must be very significant. What about you, Jean-Vive? Also, we've been hearing about you. Are you a more recent entrant to IJV?
Yeah, so I got involved with IJV as an organization a little over a year ago now. I kind of come from a different background than Corey in that I kind of, my family has never, I didn't grow up particularly immersed in Zionism or really with a, like, an understanding of Jewish life that was connected specifically to Israel. So for me, IJV was really the first space that I really found that it was possible to be both Jewish and anti-Zionist, and as a result, I was really attracted to the organization because these types of spaces that for people who kind of grow up a certain way and often as a result of the conflations of Judaism and Zionism, either hide that part of their identity or kind of self just kind of divorce that, themselves from that their part of their identity because it's so kind of intertwined with Zionism. So for me, joining IJV was really an opportunity to explore both what it meant to be Jewish in an alternative space that wasn't rooted in Zionism.
Yes, I see commonality between these two stories, and I guess one of the words that comes up is alternative. You know, for the longest time, certainly when I was growing up, there was only one way for Jewish youth to grow up in the Jewish community, and that was through the establishment institutions, which were and today are increasingly overwhelmingly pro-Israel, pro-occupation in that sense. And there was no other way to have a Jewish identity, at least not one that would be apparent growing up in Toronto or Hamilton, something like that. So what we're seeing is there is a need and a growing need to create an alternative for Jewish youth. And you see that happening in the United States with various organizations and the United Kingdom, that more and more young people do not feel represented by these pro-Israel organs. So for you, it's a personal journey, but it's also something you're trying to help other people with. So with IJV and through IJV, what do you think it means to create an alternative organization, an alternative perception for Jewish youth?
I think it's so important because for me personally, like, and for a lot of other younger folks that I do know, is they kind of gave up on being Jewish or didn't know what that really meant in a way that wasn't, you know, inherently tied to Israel. So IJV is so important as an organization in that for many people who are kind of beginning to question what they've been brought up to believe in about Zionism and about Israel and what it means to be Jewish, a lot of times they feel like they have no place to really turn to or just have to kind of stop being Jewish because it's been so connected to being, you know, supportive of Israel. So these types of spaces really thrive as alternative, as you were saying before, but as ways for people to kind of explore that part of their identity without kind of like with very, very much, you know, creating like Jewish communities that are rooted in the concepts of social justice and repairing the world and bringing peace and justice for everyone and not just, you know, just really rooted in the concepts of Zionism and settler colonialism.
Certainly. And there's an increasing awareness of the importance of this, even in Hamilton with the Jewish Liberation Theology Institute. We've spoken with Robert Ruth. We've spoken with David Mivisser and others who are involved in this very project of healing the world and trying to restore this soul that used to exist within mainstream Judaism. Now, Corey, you know, it's good to hear about all of this, but there's obviously a lot of organizing work that has to be done on the ground. And in that sense, we have this 10th anniversary of Independent Jewish Voices. Before we say anything about that, for our listeners, would you be able to elaborate a bit on what this conference is this weekend, what is going to be happening there?
Absolutely. Just before I do that, though, I just want to add something with respect to creating these alternative communities, and especially amongst youth. I agree. You know, I didn't have that either as a space when I grew up, of course. And I just wanted to point out that it's significant that this year, going into this school year, we have now 8 IJV clubs on campuses across Canada. Last year we had 2.5. So I think really we've really been putting effort into actively working to create those spaces and having, you know, you're very privileged in Hamilton to now have 2 rabbis, you know, both of whom are active in IJV, to really, help create those spaces and, you know, practice, you know, have these Jewish ritual practices that are, you know, kind of inspired by Jewish tradition to express solidarity with Palestinians and others. So I definitely see that as something that we're really working on, that's really helping to also create more sense of sort of community amongst Jews like us across the country. So yeah, with respect to the conference, this conference, I think I'm very excited about it. We've been planning it for some time. So it's taking place downtown Toronto at Beverly Halls, which is the Polish Combatants Hall, it's called. No relation with sort of that history. It's just a hall downtown that we were able to secure, which is a really great space. The idea is really to celebrate 10 years of IJV. We have three panels, one Friday night and two on Saturday. And we have about 8 workshops. I think anyone involved in this issue in any way would find all of this very, very engaging. The first night we have, I'm speaking on the panel along with the executive director of Jewish Voice for Peace, someone from the radical Jewish group in the UK, Judith, who's coming to be on that panel. And the idea there is to really talk about the sort of shifts that are happening in our respective countries amongst Jews, and to talk about the role that each of our respective organizations sort of play in that, in kind of pushing that shift and creating these alternative Jewish spaces and uniting sort of alternative Jewish voices.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was just thinking, yes, with regard to what's happening in the United Kingdom, in particular with the Corbyn campaign and this whole media barrage against him, it will be extremely helpful to have sort of a rethinking and reassessment within the Jewish community over, you know, how they want to look at the issue of anti-Semitism and how they want to be able to support politicians that are engaged in Palestine solidarity. So they have some big questions over there, and it might be addressed at the conference. Certainly it'll be very interesting to hear from this group at the conference this weekend.
Exactly. And actually this group, if listeners aren't familiar, they got international news when they invited Jeremy Corbyn actually to a Passover Seder, and there was a right wing spy there that released some details about the conference about the Passover Seder. And I mean, Judas is very they're very funny, they're very satirical in their approach.
Well, they'd have to be for an organization called Judas, right? That's J-E-W-D-A-S. I think that's the acronym.
Exactly.
Yeah, what their Twitter is as well. So Twitter is lovely.
Yeah. So playing off of Judas, of course. J-U-D-A-S. So we're very excited to have them here. We, you know, and of course we all have, you know, we all face similar challenges in our societies, not least, of course, the campaigns to pass this new definition of anti-Semitism, which basically considers anti-Zionism to be anti-Semitism. And, you know, JVP, so Jewish Voice for Peace in the U.S., recently launched a open letter, which now 40 plus organizations around the world, Jewish organizations around the world, signed on to. You know, IJV was a part of that as well, really opposing that approach. So it'll be good to talk about that and to share kind of experiences and think of ways to challenge that collectively.
Yeah, you know, all this whole discussion brings me to something I've been wondering about, and IJV, you guys have been in the news a lot recently. You know, as I said, activity has really picked up thanks to the activity of you two and others and many others. And so there was that NDP policy convention not too long ago, something we covered on this program fairly extensively. As well, let's face it, my co-host was there, and one of our friends from Hamilton and Labour was there. Henry, you've met him. And so we followed what went on there, and I know Doug and Henry put in a lot of work to try to get that resolution pushed up to the front and talked about seriously. Obviously, you encountered many difficulties which we've addressed somewhat, people are somewhat familiar with already. I'm wondering, Genevieve, you were there. Corey, were you there as well?
No, I wasn't there.
Okay.
Genevieve can speak to that.
Okay, because what I want to learn about is, I guess in the case of Genevieve, what were you trying to accomplish there in terms of the presence at the NDP convention? What was the goal, and how do you feel about the results of the convention?
Yeah, for sure. So myself, along with organizers, Sam Hirsch from Ottawa and Omar Bergen from Ottawa and Yasmin Kader from Halifax, we were kind of the four. There was many people working on the development of this resolution, and we were really successful in having it signed by over 28 riding associations and having it passed, you know, unanimously at the youth convention. So our goal with this piece of policy, which essentially would have seen the NDP refuse to, the policy of the party would be to ban settlement products from the illegal settlements, among other clauses. But what we were really successful with this resolution is because it ultimately didn't pass. We lost the vote by something like 11 votes. But what we were able to do is really kind of organize some of the largest mass mobilization in support of Palestinian rights in the history of the NDP party, and show the party that this is something that is something that we really do need to talk about in a really frank and open way, and that there is a lot of support for these types of policies. Something like 92%, I believe, of NDP supporters believe that it's right to boycott products from the illegal settlements. So this is not something that is particularly revolutionary. This is something that the membership is really calling for. So what we were really hoping to do with this is encourage people to organize and be inclusive and create soft allies in these types of policies to really push the party on this issue, where we can see that there's been a systemic shift within the party to kind of recognize that this is something we need to be talking about, but also to really push them and hold them to accountable to do a lot more.
Absolutely. Obviously, there was a big battle on the convention floor. I saw the videos. I discuss them on other programs. There are obviously many delegates who are enthusiastic about this policy and this resolution. And, you know, as they're all lined up, dozens of people all in a big line holding up signs. There was all sorts of chatter at the conference. The membership, there's a lot of the membership is enthused about this. And it's, you know, it's long past due for the NDP, for social democracy, for unions in Canada to reflect the views of membership on this mm-hmm. issue. You know, I guess this will be an ongoing issue, of course, and it's an ongoing issue.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, here in Quebec, in the UK, and so on. So we'll definitely be hearing more about that as time goes on. And ultimately, we are celebrating the 10th anniversary of Independent Jewish Voices. And, you know, in 10 years, there's been the creation of an organization that can speak outside of establishment channels, engage in campaigns like the one against the JNF, things like that, able to host events and coordinate people. So there's been all these developments since it was founded. In terms of the future and what you're working on now, where do you hope to see Independent Jewish Voices 10 years from now?
Mm-hmm. So, no, I agree that we've definitely come a long way in 10 years, for sure, and really have created this this strong organization, which I think we can all be very proud of. I see us, we're really taking the time this year to kind of adapt, actually, the way the organization functions to the size of it. Now, because I don't think we'd really caught up. So really just trying to, work on professionalizing our communications and kind of bringing more folks into the kind of national organizing that have different skills and different, different viewpoints and perspectives that can really kind of enriching the organization. And I think we're really lucky to have a very close relationship with Jewish Voice for Peace in the U.S., which of course is much bigger. They now have, 30-something staff people and, 50, 60, 70 chapters across the U.S. Of course, you know, we can't, we'll never be that big because the U.S. is, of course, much bigger. But I think they've really shown us that it's possible. Apparently, JVP is also the fastest growing Jewish organization in the U.S., which is not surprising. And I think, you know, we're getting there as well. And I think, you know, just kind of increasing our capacity to be able to actually, you know, do real lobbying work to create, you know, the strong communities. We have chapters across the country. So we have those bases there. But, you know, we really want to focus on, you know, building capacity at the local level, you know, creating these communities so that, you know, we can really have pressure in a way and also, you know, kind of spaces open for Jews across the country, whether it's as a kind of national voice or it's, you know, dealing with more local issues or campus issues. So I think, yeah, I mean, I just see us growing. We've just this past year, you know, we've been growing a lot. I think with every new settlement and every, you know, round of protesters killed in Gaza, we get more and more members, more and more support. We're really also working on getting more support from unions, which has really been actually successful in the last little while. I think there's a lot of interest there in collaborating more. So
I think so. Labor and progressive Jewish voices should be working together. In fact, that's how this program, Unusual Sources, was created. So we're very happy to hear about that. And as the organization unfolds, I think it becomes more clear what you want to do and what needs to be done. So that's good too. Now, I guess as we close out, people might be interested in the conference, the convention. Is it open to non-Jewish people as well? I mean, like, let's say you're a Jewish person, not Jewish person, you want to get involved. You just heard about this. And is it too late, or can people go to the conference this weekend and still sign up for it?
Absolutely. So we still do have some room left, not too much. So don't wait long if you want to register. But the Friday night and Saturday all day, Friday evening, it starts at around 6:30, and then we have a klezmer band afterwards to celebrate on the Friday evening. Then Saturday, it's about 9 to 5 or so. And those 2 days are open to the public, and the Sunday is for members only. So you would have had to have joined as of October 1st to be able to participate in that. But, you know, folks are welcome, if not, to join Friday and Saturday, and yeah, it's, you know, whether you're Jewish or not, you're more than welcome. You know, you can be the members of IJV are all Jewish, and then we also have supporters who participate with us and support in different ways.
Yeah, I guess it would be termed allies in the current parlance. so there you are. Okay, well, thanks so much for, I know you're busy with the organizing and all this, so we won't keep you, but we very much appreciate this. We'll give out a web link when we put this online as to where people can find the conference, where people can find independent Jewish voices. So we really appreciate this. Both of you, thanks so much for being on the program with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Wisconsin Nature Notes from the Nature Conservancy. What is singing, blooming, creeping, and crawling in the Badger State?
In October, most of the plant world is shutting down ahead of a long winter. But simultaneously, many plants are also seeking new worlds by sending out their seeds. To help the seeds travel as far as possible, plants utilize an amazing array of strategies. Some, like the black cherry, put a final gift wrap over the seeds, something bright, colorful, and sweet-tasting to encourage transport by way of digestive systems. Other plants, like thistle, choose to make their seeds sticky or bristly in order to hitch a ride to another town. Some create an aerodynamic appendage, like the milkweed's silk parachute or sugar maple's winged helicopter. Still others coat their seeds in a waterproof jacket that acts like a PFD, floating the embryo down the river to rest on a shoreline. Once in their new world, the seeds have sensors that will respond to the right combination of temperature, light, oxygen, and moisture to initiate growth. If the conditions aren't perfect, the seeds may not germinate for years. The record for patience may be 10,000-year-old lupin seeds, which were found in 1954 and then placed on wet filter paper, where 6 seeds germinated within 48 hours. One plant, upon reaching 11 months of age and after 10,000 years of dormancy, bloomed. Timing is everything in the dispersal of seeds. Red oaks, for example, typically shed their acorns just before most leaves drop. Their acorns benefit from the cover of newly fallen leaves, which ensures that some acorns will be hidden from predators, while others will be found and dispersed by squirrels and chipmunks intent on hiding their winter stores. Banner crops of acorns come every 3 or 4 years. One researcher tracked 15,000 acorns that were dropped by one prolific tree. Deer, squirrels, and other animals ate 83% of them. 6% were attacked by weevils and insect larvae, and about 10% were naturally imperfect and failed to germinate. Less than 1% actually sprouted, and more than half of those died as seedlings. Fortunately, only one acorn needs to survive to replace the adult tree above it. Whatever the strategy employed, it's clear that NASA couldn't have designed better spaceships than the seeds of most plants. Learn how you can take part in conservation in Wisconsin. Go to the Nature Conservancy's website at nature.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Nature Notes is the work of the Nature Conservancy in Wisconsin and Mind's Eye Audio in Madison.